an unusual meeting, an irregularly scheduled off time joint meeting to start with programs and services and finance. I will very quickly introduce who I see from programs and services. I'll then turn it over to Councillor Grossman to introduce finance. And then we have two agenda items that we will take jointly before we allow our colleagues on finance to either attend for the rest of the night or go about their merry way. And everyone should know that we are being video and audio recorded as well. I do see new TV here, so we may be being broadcast as well. Not sure. On the Programs and Services Committee, I thought I saw Councillor Greenberg. Is Councillor Greenberg here?
We do have a full attendance now.
I'm not seeing Councillor Greenberg at the moment, but I know.
I just submitted her.
Okay. I'm here.
Great. From Ward 1, we have Councillor Greenberg. From Ward 2, we have President Albright. From Ward 3, Councillor Pam Wright. From Ward 5, Councillor Bill Humphrey. From Ward 6, we have the Vice Chair, Brenda Noel. From Ward 7, Lyle Baker. And from Ward 8, Holly Ryan. I am the chair. From Ward 4, Josh Quinton. Councillor Grossman, do you want to tell us who's here from Finance?
Sure. Good evening. I'm Becky Grossman, Chair of the Finance Committee. I'm joined by the Vice Chair of the Committee, Councillor Kalis, who's from Ward 8. Councillor Maliki from Ward 3, Councillor Humphrey from Ward 5, Councillor Noel from Ward 6, and that is all of us at the moment.
Thank you very much. The first item on our joint agenda is item 421-20. This is the transfer of $400,000 to the Forestry Division of Parks, Recreation, and Culture. I should have asked beforehand. Jonathan, are you presenting this one? Is someone else? I apologize for it. Mark, maybe?
Maureen and Mark.
Thank you.
Maureen Lemieux. I'm so not used to having you at our meetings. What an absolute treat. Ms. Lemieux, please.
Thank you. Actually, I think Mark may want to start this. I'll start it just quickly. As I think you know, we have had three substantial wind events already in this current fiscal year. So when we had the first one, I actually said to Nicole, our commissioner, and Mark Welch, I don't want to do anything yet because with all the COVID expenses and all the uncertainties, let's see if you can make it through the year without us supplementing your budget. The second event came along and it was not a huge event. And so I really, again, was hoping we could more or less hold off. And then once they were hit with the third event, there's just no way that we can do what we want to accomplish in the forestry division now with all of the storms that we have had. So they had some money to carry forward from last year, but at this point, we just really need to supplement their budget. So I will turn it over to either the commissioner or the deputy commissioner, who's ever going to talk about it, but to, you know, certainly set the stage for it. They've just been hit too hard.
Sure. Great. Thing. More.
I think. Go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I'll be discussing the forestry piece, and the commissioner will jump in if she like to add anything. So as Maureen just mentioned, we've had three really large tree events so far this fiscal year. And believe it or not, we've actually had four within the calendar year that have been pretty large. So a lot of you have probably seen areas in the city where we've had some form of tree damage. None of those events that we've had this year are abnormal for the time of year that they happen. Every year, late September, early October, we get some type of a wind event. It's not very frequently we'll get a tropical event like we had in August. And in July, actually, also we had a thunderstorm. None of those things are abnormal. In the last at least 20 years, though, we never have more than two of these major events in any given calendar year. And so far, we've had four. So it's been an abnormal year for weather. And unfortunately, that results in our need to bring in additional contracted services for response to the storms, and also for our staff to work additional overtime. What I would say, though, is, you know, through, you know, the assistance of the administration, this administration, the prior administration, Maureen specifically, about 7-8 years ago, we started to work towards increasing our in-house capabilities. And it's really providing, or the results are important, because not only are we doing more in-house stuff, normal day-to-day work, it really comes in handy in storms. So having this staff and making the decisions we have about equipment has really helped, because I just did the quick numbers earlier today. And if we didn't have our in-house staff, so if this was 8 years ago when we didn't have our in-house staff, this request would be $500,000 more than it is today. So the in-house, having our in-house staff that we do have really helps. But when it comes to large storms and the frequency or the quickness that we like to be able to address the down debris, we don't have a choice but to bring in our contractors. So our expenses are a direct result of that.
Thank you. Where is the commissioner? Is she here? Did she want to speak?
Hi, I just wanted to thank Mark and his team. We saw so many requests coming in from our residents during these storms, and the impact was quite widespread, so they did a great job. This was my first season getting to see this. We'll now be coming into the snow season, so knock on wood, maybe this will get us a little break there. Also, just wanted to note that those same storms that impacted us citywide and that we were dealing with the cleanups for quite some time also impacted Eversource. And I've been following up with Eversource to get the athletic field lights at Newton South turned on. And I'm happy to report that we have them in there this week. They were on site today. So we're hopeful that we'll have those lights on this Friday, but we've seen a lot of impacts and backups because of these storms. And I'll turn it back to Maureen if she wants to say anything else about the finances, and just appreciate you taking a look at this request for us.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Lemieux.
Yeah, thank you. If I may, just because this is a joint meeting, so the financial piece of it, I believe you all probably realize that we actually budgeted $4.5 million in this year's budget for snow and ice removal, and we have dipped into it for each of the last several years for tree issues. In addition to that, we have $880,000 that we received last year from the storms from the spring of 2018 that we have set aside in our inclement weather reserve. We also carried forward $700,000 from last year's snow and ice reserve that was not spent because we did better last year than we typically do. And I believe Public Works also carried forward an extra $100,000 in snow costs that you had all transferred to them that in the end, we didn't end up spending. So we began this year with $6.1 million from, if I add each of those sources together, before we even talk about free cash for us to deal with weather events. This $400,000 is coming out of, I believe I docketed it, to come from the reserve that we have in the comptroller's office. That brings us down to 5.7. 5.7 is actually the five-year average, and that's our target number that on an average year we should expect to spend. So I still have 5.7 for snow and ice, and that's before we would then move to free cash. We've had two winters in the last six or seven that have where we've spent over $7 million on snow and ice removal, so it's not out of the question, which is why I make sure that I have at least a few million set aside in free cash also. So just so that everyone understands financially, even with this $400,000 transfer, we will be entering the winter months with 5.7 in place before we go or need to access free cash.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Lemieux, Councilor Grossman, if it's okay with you, I'll just call on people as I see their hands.
Please.
Okay. President Albright, do you have a question? Sorry, let me just make sure. That was the end, right? There's nothing anyone else wants to say to introduce this item? Commissioner Banks, Ms. Lemieux. Okay. Yeah, President Albright.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered my question, but I just want to make sure I understand. So along with the typical amount of money that you put in snow and ice reserve, you had these other reserves, which the carryover for, I guess there were two separate carryovers, the inclement weather and the other one. So that total to, what was the total it used to be? Add 6.1. So we still have a significant amount of money in the snow removal.
You're correct, Counselor. We still have 5.7 that's really dedicated to snow and ice. And then our free cash was actually certified probably about 2 weeks ago now. And so I always hold back free cash. I would never come to you looking to spend any of the free cash until we get through the winter months so that we make sure we can handle any snow and ice events that we may have. So we're actually in a good place. Our free cash was not as high as it has been because of COVID-19 and all the different revenue sources that I mentioned last week that did not come in at budget. Our free cash ended up being less than it has been over the last several years, but certainly still enough free cash that we will save a few million to make sure that we get through the winter.
So how much was certified?
7.3 and change.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're all set, President Albright?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Councilor Grossman.
Thank you. So I just wanted to ask Ms. Lemieux to take a second and explain, especially for folks who are newer to the council, or for anybody who hasn't heard Ms. Lemieux explain it before, the work that the city has done over the course of the last number of years to build up the snow and ice removal account to get to the point where we know we eventually need to be. Because actually, I think the position that you just explained we're in, Ms. Lemieux, is really strong compared to the years that I've been on the council and in terms of where we're beginning. If you could just sort of talk about that trajectory and where you're trying to get to overall.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. When I first started with the city, so now it was about 10 and a half years ago. So in 2010, for those of you who have been on the board for years, you will recall that the city would budget $1 million a year to deal with the cost that we incur for snow and ice removal. We have spent over the course of the years, now we are up to, on an average winter, we spend $5.7 million. We were only budgeting $1 million a year. That meant that the first $4.7 million or whatever our average was back then of free cash had to be held because the presumption was that we would use free cash to pay for all of the snow removal. So what we started doing in 2011, which was actually the fiscal 12 budget, is the first one that I was here to prepare. I think the first year or two, we added probably $500,000 in each of the first 2 years. And since then, every year we've increased that appropriation by $250,000. That has gotten us to a point where we budgeted in fiscal 20, $4.5 million, knowing that our average is $5.7 million. Because of COVID, we did not add to it. And so we kept it level funded. But what we did do because of COVID is that we carried forward the 700 of unspent snow money from last year, as well as the 100 that we had in public works. And we took the 880,000 that was a reimbursement for fiscal 18. We took that and set that aside for snow. So we did start this year in a very good position. Especially because of COVID, we were worried back when we put the budget together that we may have significantly less free cash even than we were able to certify. So we are in good shape. We've worked very hard to get here. The council has been incredibly supportive, adding to this number every year. And it makes such a huge difference because it makes us less dependent on having to generate free cash.
Thank you. That was helpful for me. At least I hadn't heard that. Councilor Grossman, you all set?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. I am not seeing other hands at the moment. I think you guys did an excellent job of presenting this and explaining and answering the questions we had. So I'm happy to take a vote in programs and services, and then I'll turn it over to Councilor Grossman. Is there a motion on 421-20?
So moved.
Okay, I heard move approval from President Albright. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right, I got 8-0 in programs and services. Councilor Grossman?
Okay, is there a motion in finance on this item?
So moved, positively.
Approval moved by Councilor Kalis, and we usually raise our blue hands just because it's easier for me. So if everybody wouldn't mind. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I tried to raise my own. I don't know if, there we go, 5 in favor, any opposed? I don't think we have anybody else here right now, right? Okay, I think we're 5-0.
Great, thank you everybody. The next item and the final joint item is 49-20(2). This is requesting establishment of a fee for the registration of leaf blower contractors. Councillor Baker, do you maybe and Ms. Lawler want to speak a little bit about the work that you've done and what we're looking for finance to do as well?
Sure. And Ms. Lawler, please come in whenever I'm say something that we should amplify and or correct if I say something and needs correcting. For members of finance, the Programs and Services Committee has been looking at ways to enhance compliance with the leaf blower rules that we have in the city. And the item that we discussed in committee was to try and find a regime that would assist that objective, because there are a number of contractors who are regular users of leaf blowers who are complying with the law, but there are also a number that I've personally observed who are not. And so it's putting the people who are doing their best to comply in a competitive disadvantage because they're not able to work in quite the same way. and it seemed to us also that the public interest in making sure that our ordinances are complied with was important. So what Ms. Lawler and I did over the summer was work to find out how this might have worked in other communities. And the our colleagues in the Programs and Services know this background a little. But we looked to the town of Brookline, which had developed a registration process so that the process of registration would say that if you're planning to use a leaf blower for commercial purposes, that you come in and register and get a permit from the city. And so the registration process requires a permit, and the permit requires some time of the Inspectional Services Department to process the registration request, and therefore a fee is in order. And we have to decide, or the Finance Committee is new to this, but jointly, but ultimately the Council needs to decide what fee is appropriate, and I hope we'll hear from Mr. Yeo about that issue. But the purpose of the registration is really to have the contractors understand the rules, certify that they understand them, and then indicate that they will instruct their staff to comply, and also post a registration number and the evidence of their registration on their truck so that people will know that they are in fact in compliance. And then if people operate without permission enough times and get into a, not permission, but operate illegally, they can lose their registration. But also to provide a positive reinforcement of compliance, those contractors who have registered and indicated they will support and comply with the law would be able to be listed as Brookline does on the city website so that property owners would understand what contractors have come forward. Also, there was some confusion as we understood it in the enforcement process because as the ordinance is currently drawn, it talks about the person operating the leaf blower and often the actual operator is a member of a crew, not the landscaper organization. And therefore, when the police come to enforce, if they have to first see the operation and then they have to decide whether this person has operated before illegally, and that's difficult to do. And so another modification that Ms. Lawler and I'm willing, would like to recommend is that we clarify that the responsible party is the contractor, not the actual person on the ground who's actually doing the job, because they just get handed the equipment and said, please go take care of this task. And then another clarification is to indicate that as in Brookline, that the property owner is also responsible, not just the contractor, because if there is a responsibility for this. It ought to be where it originates. And so all of that is the background in committee of programs and services. There were some questions about the enforceability using the police, but we left the police in charge of the compliance, except for there obviously some opportunity for inspectional services, but they don't have the field staff. And so we hope that, in fact, this process will relieve the police of some calls that they would otherwise get, because people begin to play by the rules, and therefore the police don't get complaints and they don't have to spend time. So this is a way of trying to relieve our police of some of their duties, even though the responsibility is formally lodged in them. The only thing that's different, I think, from what the committee saw last time is that we had an opportunity to look at some parallel work in Cambridge, and they had some technical language of clarification about definitions that Ms. Luller and I conferred about and seemed to be useful to adapt to the Newton situation. So the last version of this draft that was sent to you late today constitutes the version that incorporates the technical edits that we think will enhance the value of this process. So we are hopeful that the committees, but also the administration, because the administration has to implement this, will adopt this regime so that we can try and assure our citizens that we're doing what we can to try and have the law complied with. Ms. Luller, should you want to add anything to what I've said?
Thank you, Councillor Baker. I think your summary of the changes that are being proposed was very thorough. And just to summarize, the two major changes that are being proposed to what our current leaf blower ordinance is, as Councillor Baker said, is number one, adding the property owner to the responsible to as one of the responsible parties, and the other is to institute a program for registration of the commercial leaf blower operators. And if you will notice on your red line that is actually marked second revised with the date 10/28/20 on it, it has all of the red lines and the changes that were discussed at Programs and Services Committee meeting last time, including several changes that were requested by the committee. And one of those was to clarify that it is not the contractor's employees on the ground who would be liable for violations, but the contractor or the owner of the company. So I would be happy to. The other change we've made, in addition to adding an actual definition for commercial leaf blower operator, as Councillor Baker said, was to move the definition of leaf blower that we already have, but to move it from the front part of the noise ordinance section to this section H, which deals specifically with leaf blowers, and that is for simplicity's sake and to make it more understandable for the public and for contractors. It can be easily printed off just that section, and it is a section unto itself, as it were. So I would be happy to answer any questions or go through each section in more detail. I will note that you probably have a typo on the second page in section 7B, where it says a commercial leaf blower operator shall ensure that its name, address, telephone number, and its commercial leaf blower, it should say commercial leaf blower permit, but somehow the keys got away from me, apparently. So we would just make that commission. It's not leaf blowery. It's leaf blower, commercial leaf blower permit.
We're trying to speak French.
Yeah, I actually like that word. Maybe we do want to incorporate it. Sounds great.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I'm seeing the hands popping up, which is good because we'll have a nice healthy discussion about this. But Councilor Baker, I just have a process question first.
Sure.
Sorry, which you may be familiar with someone.
The irony is not lost on me.
I just want to be clear. The joint component of this is exclusively the fee. Is that right?
That's correct.
The part that finance and programs and services will both need to approve is about the fee. Certainly, for context and to help set the stage for why the fee is required. But in terms of the vote that finance will have to take tonight and that we will take on the first item, it's about the fee and the setting of the fee. Is that right?
I understand. Ms. Lawler?
Yes, that's right. And if you'll notice, we had when we had been discussing it over the summer with programs and services, we had just put a nominal fee as a placeholder. I think discussions with Mr. Lojek and with Commissioner Lojek and with we have put in another placeholder, which is $100. Bearing in mind, as the committee discusses what fee they want to charge, that it does have to be designed to reimburse the city for its costs in running the program. There will be stickers, there'll be permits, there'll be et cetera, right, including including keeping up with the lists and so forth.
Okay.
So that's one thing. The other thing that I do think the committee, the finance committee needs to look at is the proposed new fine for violations of Section 7, which requires a $300 fine, which we're proposing a $300 fine for any commercial operator operating a leaf blower without a valid permit.
Good point. Thank you. I appreciate that. And so I don't know if it's properly characterized as a recommendation or a placeholder, but at the moment the discussion is going to start with a $100 registration. Correct? Okay. Why don't we see what some people have to say about this? And I think anyone on either committee or any counselor here can weigh in. Is there anyone else who wanted to weigh in on this before we have some council discussion? Mr. Yeo, Yeah, Mr. Yeo.
Thank you. Thank you to the team that's worked on this. Couple thoughts on this. The first is that the administration really believes that there should be a lot of discussion about this. I mean, these are some real changes to quite a controversial ordinance. And to the degree you can do some outreach to the impacted stakeholders, we think that would really be wise, and conduct a public hearing as well. So these are some real changes to this ordinance. And so that is our first recommendation. I haven't seen the latest version. If somebody could send it to me, that would be great. We do think that the fee should be fairly nominal. Yes, there are stickers that will have to be printed, and some permitting costs. Hopefully our new permitting system will be able to handle this with no problem whatsoever. So whether it's $25 or $100, it should be nominal. We're not trying to raise money off of this. Maureen isn't that desperate right now, so you don't need to comment on that. There's a couple issues here. I'm not sure if you're trying to separate the two, if you're trying to cover chair people, if you're trying to cover this whole issue here, or if you're trying to separate your committee's work on this right now. So, because there's a couple issues, some of them aren't related to the financial part of it. So,
right. At the moment, I think we're just talking about the financial aspects.
Okay.
The other part is relevant because the committee obviously needs to understand it.
So I'm looking to the chairs to how far to go. I guess our only other major point is just on enforcement, just to be clear, I get that it's good to have the landscaper, the landscaping company a focus. You also put in the homeowner, and Marie, I'm looking at you and Lyle, are they both gonna get a fine or is it just one? How would this work? And we just need to be really clear with the public how this is gonna go down.
I think it could be one or both. It would depend on the enforcement. And I believe that is the way it is in Brookline. It doesn't say that if one is liable gets a violation that the other won't. It's they're jointly liable. So the other thing, just Jonathan, I think I emailed you. I think you might have a copy if you check your email. I had emailed the latest version to Nathan, and I believe you were CC'd on that. And if you weren't,
all right, I will check.
Just double check.
I'm just thinking of the police officer who arrives at the scene, and maybe they've been seen before. They're issuing a warning or a penalty. Is it to the landscaping company, or are they also going to walk up to the door and issue one to the homeowner? And so it's, I'm just thinking about the officer who's dealing with the situation. So
okay,
we can think some more about that.
We appreciate it. All right. Thank you, Mr. Yeo. Councilor Kalis, I see you with your hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of continuing on what Mr. Yeo was talking about, I definitely do not think the homeowner should be fined on this. And I have a question as to how do they officially authorize their landscaper to use a leaf blower? Is there some authorization that they need to sign?
No, there is under the draft and the recommendation, there is registration requirements for commercial landscapers. And when the commercial landscaper registers with the city, they sign an attestation that they have read through the leaf blower ordinance, understand the requirements of it, and that they can be held responsible.
Okay, that's good. But it also reads in there that the homeowner has to authorize that the commercial operator has approval to use it. So that was my confusion.
No, there's not.
Don't think that's the case.
Not the case.
Okay.
If I may.
I'm hearing some pushback from Ms. Lawler and Councilor Baker.
They authorize them by hiring the company, right.
Hiring them. Okay.
They are not authorizing them. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify, how they were actually authorizing. Yeah. That makes sense. And the thing about, I just don't want the police involved more than they need to be in all of our lives. And this whole idea that they might fine the homeowner, I just don't think that they need to go there. So this is really about the commercial operator, and this is about registering that they're going to be using leaf blowers. So I really don't think we should go with the homeowner at all. The other thing I wanted to ask about is...
Excuse me, can I clarify something?
Let's let Councilor Kalis finish.
Sure.
What I wanted to ask about, so it says that there has to be three times that the commercial operator is fined or is caught, I guess. Will this actually ever happen realistically three times? Because what I'm hearing is that if somebody's using a leaf blower that is stronger than they're supposed to be using, the police don't get there anyway. So it seems like three is a very, it gives them a lot of leeway. And I think if we have a rule that says you have to register, then it should be one time, maybe two, but three just seems like a lot.
I'll turn it over to Councilor Baker. My recollection is that the commercial contractors can be held responsible in the very first violation. There's no requirement for three violations. But Councilor Baker, you wanted to answer, some of that?
I think that there's a distinction between the commercial permit process and I think the property owner being liable for a violation of the use of the equipment. I think there's a difference here, and that's part of the concern, I think, that it wasn't clear.
I think the homeowner is entitled to a warning before any fine can be levied, unlike the commercial registered or a commercial user who is not registered who can be fined on the very first violation. Do I have that right, Ms. Lawler?
Yes, I think that would be the case.
Yeah. Does that answer your question, Councilor Kalis?
Yeah, I think I have to read it, the whole thing, a lot closer. Okay. But those are my thoughts right now.
Okay. Thank you. Councilor Humphrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just sort of initially responding to what Councilor Kalis just said. So, I mean, people can obviously disagree. We did have a lot of discussion over several months about who should be getting the fines, and one of the points was that there were a lot, the consensus on the committee was that there should be some skin in the game on the homeowner side as well. But again, people can feel free to disagree on that point. I guess I know this isn't directly related to the part about the money, but I think it does come up in the sense of handing out a citation. I think that we still need to revisit that enforcement question, because that was something that was brought up a lot in the previous committee meetings, was that a lot of us didn't feel comfortable with, you know, expanding the policing on this, that we would prefer somebody else to be doing it. And I know we haven't quite solved that question, but I want to just reiterate that, especially for the finance committee members who haven't been part of this discussion all summer and early fall. That's it.
Thank you, Councilor Breen. That's fair. And I appreciate you certainly reminding of that. So I think you're absolutely correct. That conversation is not yet over. Definitely something that we need to continue to have. And I think helpful also to point out that we did have a fairly robust discussion, and the genesis of this, you know, as Councilor Baker touched on, was that we have an existing leaf blower ordinance and there are problems enforcing it. And so what are some ways that we can look to facilitate the enforcement or enhance the enforcement? And the two main things we came up with were commercial registration and acknowledgement of the requirements, but also, as Councilor Humphrey says, some skin in the game on the part of the homeowner, so that if it is their contractors who are continuously or repeatedly violating the leaf blower ordinance, they're on alert to potentially hire alternate contractors, or at least put the word out to their contractors to be more compliant. Councilor Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. I am a member of Programs and Services, and so we did have a lot of great discussion on this. I just want to reiterate what Councilor Humphrey said. I'm on the side of getting enforcement like this away from the Newton police. I don't think it's their job to be doing this, and I'm very adamant on that, and it could keep me from voting yes on any of this. And that's how adamant I am about this. I see that Chief Mintz, is he still here? If he wanted to chime in on that, I'd appreciate it, but he doesn't have to.
Chief Mintz is here. Chief Mintz, if you want to chime in, we're happy to hear from you.
All right.
Seeing no unmuting, I'm going to assume that you want to stay quiet. Okay, go ahead, Chief.
Well, I'll say good evening, and certainly the police will accommodate, you know, what the city council wants and the administration as well. I know that some of the officers feel that, as far as the ordinance is concerned, that the court might have a problem with fining the homeowner, and is there going to be any guidance in the ordinance about how do we determine if the homeowner is knowledgeable about the violation? Does somebody go to work and their landscaper shows up and they violate the law? You know, are they really responsible for that? So I think that's an issue. It would place officers at times with, you know, a negative interaction with the public. And the other thing is, it would probably be a statute or an ordinance where the citizen wouldn't be required to identify themselves. What happens if they won't tell us who they are? If that happens when somebody's driving a car, that they would be arrested. But in this situation, it puts the officer in kind of a difficult situation. So it's very complicated, but we certainly do go now to a number of leaf blower calls. I could send anybody the statistics that are up to date to the beginning of, of September this year and for three previous years. And I'd certainly be willing to try to answer any questions and supply any statistics from our crime analyst, if that would be helpful.
Thank you, Chief. Councilor Ryan?
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate that. So what I'm understanding now is that anyone that registers, if this passes, any landscaping company that registers gets their permit, will be put on the website, and then the homeowner can go to the City of Newton website and see if they're searching for a landscaper and see who's registered with us. And that's a good thing. It covers the homeowner. I still don't know if right now, I know the sticker will be on the truck, but what about the trucks being lettered? Right now, there are a lot of trucks that are not lettered. They don't, no company name on them, totally blank, in quite a lot of them. Are they supposed to be lettered now, or will they have to be lettered in the future?
Ms. Lawler, did you want to weigh in?
Yes, if you'll notice in the new draft, there is the addition, as we had pointed out, and this is in Section 7, which is the commercial leaf blower operator section. There is a new paragraph B, which says the commercial leaf blower operator shall ensure that its name, address, telephone number, and its commercial leaf blower permit number are clearly visible on any vehicle it uses to conduct business in Newton.
Right, but that's not, now that's not required.
It would not be required unless this is, unless the council enacts it.
All right, because I still wasn't sure on that, and that is a problem. That is a big problem. Yeah. And it is bad for the landscapers that follow the law on that. And I have one more question for you, Ms. Lala. I was informed by two landscape companies, who were people I grew up with and went to high school with here in Newton, that they had previously sued the city about, and one of the things they sued about was the homeowner being responsible. Is this true? I don't know. I don't remember.
I have never heard of that. I'm not aware of any lawsuit by any landscaper at all.
Yeah, it was supposed to have been a group. I'm just trying to clarify that. So I figured
when the leaf blower ordinance was first contemplated, there was a group of landscapers that tried to say it was unconstitutional and whatever else, but they were basically thrown out of court. So
all right, and there
they
was
did
no
not prevail. I don't think it had anything to do with the homeowner itself. Okay.
As I said, just trying to clarify that.
Right.
And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Councillor Ann. Councillor Grossman.
Thank you. So I've got a couple questions, and I'll ask them and then hold other thoughts until after I have the benefit of listening to the discussion. The first question I have is, can somebody walk through for me this revised ordinance as written? What are the action steps that would happen to a commercial landscaper who both is complying and then a commercial landscaper who is not complying? Just sort of step A, step B, step C, this is what we expect to happen. Then the second set of questions I have is around how the different fees and fines were arrived at, being mindful of Ms. Lawler's framework that she set up for us around what the costs of operating this program are, which reflect the number that was arrived at. And then the third piece of what I want to talk about is essentially kind of wondering aloud about our timing here, being particularly mindful of Councillor Humphrey and others' comments about, being mindful about asking the police to take on another layer of enforcement here, especially as we have a police reform task force going on in parallel. So I'm curious what folks' thoughts are about that. But if somebody could take parts A and B, walking me through the process and set of expectations for both a well-intentioned complying commercial landscaper and then not, and then secondly, the calculations behind the fees and fines.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe Ms. Lawler or Councilor Baker, I'll let you guys weigh in. My understanding is for, at least for the commercial contractor who is complying, they would come to the city, they would come to City Hall, fill out the paperwork, pay the $100 registration fee or whatever it is, and then conduct their business for the year. And they would understand the leaf blower ordinance, and hopefully they would, their equipment and their materials would be in compliance with the Newton leaf blower ordinance.
And they would know about this how, and secondly,
it's you mean how would they know to register?
Yeah, how would they know? And then secondly, it's, so the revised version is the $100, the $25 was sort of just the placeholder that was in there before. Is that right? Because I think there's some confusion about whether the fee is $25 or
$100. The fee is whatever you set it. We've put $25 in initially. There was some pushback from the ISD. We raised it to $100. It's still a placeholder. It should be, I think you can consider anything up to $100 is fairly nominal. But it must be really tied into the costs of the department in administering the program. So you can't, I would not suggest going above $100. $100 may be justifiable. There's a lot that goes into this. It could be $50. So it's really up to the council. And you know, if you need to, you should hear from Commissioner Lojack on what he believes is would cover or begin to cover his expenses. Often our nominal fees don't even begin to really cover them, but it helps.
But the number that is in the revised document this evening was a recommended fee that came out of discussions with Inspectional Services.
Currently 100, right?
Okay. So, and how do we expect that commercial landscapers would learn about the existence of this process, both at first as well as on an ongoing basis?
So I think my hope would be, and the administration has in the past sent letters to landscapers periodically, and Mr. Yeo has a list compiled, I know, over an extended period of time of the landscapers that operate in Newton who show up in our enforcement situations from time to time. And I hope that part of the initial activity here would be to post notice and in a number of these operators, as I understand it, also do other things and come to City Hall regularly. So I think part of the outreach is through Inspectional Services, but I hope as there has been a letter that's gone out regularly from the administration, the landscapers about the ordinance to begin with, that something along these lines would happen to say when the registration process again, Mr. Yeo should come in on that, that please be aware that this registration process is in place. I think that if I can clarify the answer to the first part, as you go through, as the chair indicated, you come in, you get your permit, say, I understand what the rules are. Here are the rules. I agree that my operators will comply. And then they go away. And if someone happens to be operating without a permit, that's a relatively easy thing for a police, I think, to notice because it requires the truck to have the identifying information, including the permit number. And my instinct would be, although Chief that should indicate how he would do it, is that the officer would say, folks, you need to get a permit, go to City Hall and get set up. I don't expect there would be enforcement on the first issue of that situation because we're interested in compliance. This is not so much on the enforcement side, it's to minimize the burden on the police so that they don't have to go out as much for the actual enforcement calls. And then for somebody who didn't comply, as you say, if they didn't go get the permit, they would be notified. And if they continued to violate, then they would be subject to the fine. The fine is just the normal civil fine that we have for civil ticketing so that it's not a criminal matter in this matter. It's really just trying to ensure compliance. And if they operate with a permit but still break the rules, they're subject to the regular sanction of a ticket. But now it's to the operator, not trying to figure out whether it's the contractor rather than the particular person that's holding the device. And second, you also have the potential loss, and Councillor Kalis's point is legitimate, of the registration privilege, which basically gives you the kind of positive publicity, but also the absence of being on the list can be a handicap to business. So we're trying to figure out ways to really make it easy for people to follow the rules, and those contractors who are following the rules, I think would find this really not a difficult problem. Most of them already have their names on their trucks. They've already got their information. So it's really just to add a permit number and sign up and say, we're going to do it and use the right equipment, and they're done. So we hope that the outliers will be relatively few, but you never know. And this is an attempt to try and again, minimize rather than add to the burden on the department.
Yeah, I will just add to that if I could. We sort of, one of the premises that I think it's safe to say we started from, at least on programs and services, was that people want to comply with the leaf blower ordinance. The vast majority of people, whether it's homeowners, commercial landscapers, whoever, want to comply. And so what were some mechanisms that we could develop to make it easier for people to comply, to make sure that people knew what the requirements were, and to facilitate a process like that?
So that and I'll stop there just with the pin in the note that what's going through my mind is also about the timing here. I understand we're in the fall season. We're in the period where leaf blowers are going to be at the height of their usage. So I'm wondering about timing of both respect to the police reform task force, as well as to Mr. Yeo's points earlier, if we're quite ready to move ahead. And I will stop there.
Thank you, Councillor Crespin. Councillor Malachy.
I'm sorry. I was going to add, I'd respond on timing if I could, just a second, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Councillor Baker, go ahead.
If and when we pass this ordinance, whatever process we take, it still has 20 days and the mayor has to sign. So I think, as much as I would welcome having additional compliance tools in place this fall, it may not be feasible. But I think we want to get something in place so that the registration process can be done relatively easily. And certainly in the beginning of the year is a time when inspectional services is not as active in the field. And it could be a time that the registration could occur, get everybody aboard, and hopefully by the season when things begin in the spring, everybody will know what's up and we can move forward from there. Now, the task force may come back and say the police shouldn't be doing any of this, and that's entirely possible. But right now, we don't have an alternative for the nights, weekend, well, not nights, but certainly after hours in the summer, but in the weekends and times when inspectional services are not on duty and they don't have the field personnel as it is. So unless and until the city is able to provide a code compliance team that can take the place of the police in situations like this, I think we're operating with the police at the moment, and I hope the idea here is that the registration process will lighten their load rather than increase it.
Right, and you know, just to also clarify, the recommendations to date do not switch the enforcing authority at all. And at least in my mind, part of the reason to do that is to wait and let the task force do their work. So, but again, you know, as Councilor Humphrey said, I think that discussion certainly needs to be had, and it needs to be a thorough and informed discussion. Councilor Malachy.
Okay, thank you. I just have a bunch of random questions. And I was not really deeply involved in the first round of this a few years ago, but I know it was very emotional, and I think it, if we're going to make this significant changes to this, I think it does merit some kind of public hearing and you know, press coverage in advance and just to make people aware of it. I am kind of sympathetic to the idea of the homeowner having skin in the game, because that almost seems like it might be more effective to get the landscapers to comply. Because right now, if they don't comply and they're fined, they might just be passing the cost of the fine on to the homeowner without them seeing it. But if the homeowner sort of explicitly gets a, you know, tag on their door or whatever, then they'd be on their landscaper's case. And if the landscaper wasn't cooperating, they'd get a different landscaper. I'm curious, would the permit fee, would that be an annual fee or a one-time thing?
It's an annual fee.
Annual. Okay.
And do we know how many landscapers there are operating in the city?
I don't have that number. Councilor Baker, do you have that? Or
I think it's probably well into 100. Mr. Yeo, yeah. You have some numbers, don't you?
I feel like at one point we saw it and it was over 100, but not over 150.
It's over 100 for sure. A lot of them change names, and it's a little tough to keep track of, but it's definitely over 100.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the idea is here is they'd have to get a permit to operate leaf blowers in the city and post that permit on the truck, and the truck has to have the company name. Have I got that right?
That's right.
Okay. Now, is you find a truck driving around and it doesn't have the permit or it doesn't have the company name, but it's full of lawnmowers and landscaping equipment. Is there a fine just for not having the proper information on the truck, aside from the leaf blower part itself?
No.
Okay, so they'd have to, it would, to incur the fine, somebody, and this was my other question, what's the kind of the standard of proof? Does the leaf blowing operation have to be personally witnessed by either the ISD person or a police officer?
The chief should comment on that, but my understanding, in enforcement, where I've understood it, is they've said they have to see the operation.
See it, yeah, okay. So with this, they'd have to see it, and so they'd be looking at the leaf blower itself to see if it's labeled or not labeled with the right decibels, and then they'd be looking at the truck. So they could, if they were, say, operating the right kind of leaf blower but the wrong hours, and so
that's a standard, that's a violation currently.
That's now, right? So the labeling the truck would just help with the enforcement that you'd know who they were.
That's right. The idea
the officer showed up.
Part of right. The challenge of the officers, they come and they see the violation, and you really it's about compliance, you know. Say, okay, whose truck is this? Have you got your permit? A communication could be made from ISD to the police to the contractor and say, look, come in and get your permit. You know, it's about compliance. It's really not trying to beat people up. It's really because we have an ordinance that allows them to be fined now. So the question is, can we do better than that for everybody?
So the idea would be first offense is a warning to go get your license, and then they go get the license.
For the commercial landscaper you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think a commercial landscaper is entitled to a warning under the draft ordinance.
Okay.
Am I right about that, Ms. Lawler?
Well, I think that's discretionary with the enforcer. I think with any violation of any, parking or traffic violations or speeding, that they can always get a warning. That's up to the enforcer.
I think the individual property owner must get a warning before a fine is levied.
Well, the way the whole noise ordinance is set up is that the first there is a warning first for any violation of the noise ordinance, so that includes leaf blower.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you had a commercial landscaper violating the ordinance, and if as you propose there's a fine to the landscaper and or the homeowner or somehow jointly, so the landscaper could get the fine right away and the homeowner could get the warning at the same time.
Well, I think as the whole noise ordinance is set up, there could be a warning first before any of them were violated. I mean, were given a ticket. So, but again, that's a piece of enforcement. But the noise ordinance, if you look at, I don't have it in front, and you may not have it in front of you, but if you go back and look at the fines, the whole noise ordinance, the first. It is first a warning, and then the fines are listed, first violation, second violation, whatever the violations are. The one difference with the commercial leaf blowers is once they do get a ticket, the fine is $300, which is the top fine that any municipality can charge unless statutorily authorized to do something else. So with other violations of the noise ordinance, there's a graduated fine. And right now, I can't remember whether it's 25, 50, whatever it is, it's a graduated fine for first offense, second offense, and third and subsequent offenses after a warning. But with for operating a leaf blower without a commercial leaf blower permit, a commercial landscaper would be subject to a $300 fine, not the graduated fines.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be three. Yeah.
But I'm hearing two different things. I'm hearing you can fine the commercial operator on a first instance.
No, I think there would be a warning.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But if they then have had a warning and they have another violation, then they don't get a $50 fine, and then a second violation, $100. They go straight to $300.
Okay. But the warning, if you had the homeowner component, the warning, each of them would get their own warning at the same time.
Right.
Okay. And I mean, the chief can chime in here, I guess. From what I've heard, I guess one of the reasons the officers don't like to enforce it is that, like, they might know the landscaper, they went to high school with them or whatever. Is the same problem going to be if they know the homeowner too? It could be a issue of kind of favoritism. If they know the person, they're more sympathetic, and if they don't know them, they're not.
Well, that's not something that I'm willing to comment on. You can speak to the chief about that. Chief may want to comment on that.
He's still here? I don't know. Did we lose him?
Well,
I don't think that's something that the city council.
I don't think that issue would come up very often, and an officer can always contact their sergeant or the officer in charge and say, you know, that's a cousin of mine or a friend of mine or whatever, or somebody I've had maybe even conflict with, and ask that they be removed from the call. So
okay. Oh, when the call comes in.
But I mean, that would come up maybe really. I mean, that can happen in motor vehicle stops, domestic calls. I mean, that is an issue that comes up occasionally.
Uh-huh.
But we can deal with that.
Okay. And it seems like whether or not the Police Reform Task Force recommends getting police out of this function or not, you'd still have, if they recommend getting the police out of the function, we'd be left with who would be enforcing it on the weekends?
There would be no one enforcing it on the weekends. The only other enforcement entity you have is ISD. ISD is only open on business days. So if you take the police out, there will be no enforcement after hours or on weekends or legal holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, just to be clear, I think that's why the current ordinance has the joint enforcement authority.
Right.
And okay. We haven't recommended a change in that at this time.
Okay. All right. Going to have to think about this some more. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Malachy. Councillor Leary, you know something about this.
Yes.
Welcome.
I had the unhappy experience of being on the first programs and services discussion on leaf blowers. I will say, I think some of the suggestions here are very, I think, are good ideas. Particularly the registration, and this did come up back, you know, going on over 3 years ago now. We did discuss registration, but at that time, the then Board of Aldermen was unwilling to entertain it. I just want to preface my comments with, first of all, I'm not in favor of fining the homeowners. And the reason for that, at least not at this juncture, is because the success of getting any relief from illegal leaf blowers really relies on a commitment from the administration and the commitment from the chief of police to really help with education, enforcement, and compliance. And really, education is the number one goal, and that that's why I would be wholly in favor of holding a public hearing and having a discussion with stakeholders, because we have to educate people first. And that's going to be, you said you think that people want to obey the law. I think that's true with homeowners. I think many of them don't even realize, well, maybe more now that more are home. But when people were going away, when our experience was people didn't even know. They leave the house at 6 or 7 a.m. and they're not realizing how much the leaf blower contractors, one after another, are impacting their neighbors who are retired or who may work at home or may have young children or maybe elderly. But I think the homeowners that came up about putting the police in an awkward situation or putting them having to, you know, walk up to someone's door with a fine or a warning. But I would see it much more as the only role that I would see for the police officer with interacting with the homeowner is having them maybe knock on the door, handing them some information, say, the city wants you to know that your contractor was in violation of our leaf blower ordinance. We want you to be aware of that. They can say warned or he'll be getting a fine or something to that effect. And being sort of a force for good, so to speak, and helping us to have a quieter community. A lot of the problems with the current ordinance is the fact that neither the administration at the time, nor do I believe the current one, really makes this a priority. And certainly in the past, the police were disdainful of the law, and there was really a lack of wanting to even work with us. And so if Chief Mintz is willing to step up and work with us on this, that would go a long way. I had some questions about coordination and administration and tracking. I actually think the fines are less of an issue. It's more important. What would really, I think, hurt any contractor is if they would lose the privilege to do business in the city of Newton. So tracking a warning versus the fine, and to the point, which I think it should be a third strike, they're no longer allowed to do business here. We have to figure out a way that we can enforce that as well. Currently, I find that any interactions I've had with the police and leaf blowers is often they don't know the law, first of all. That's an issue. Or they'll say to call. Even if there's a guy blowing a leaf blower right in front of them and they're doing detail, they'll say to call the police. So there's that problem as well. So getting people understanding what their role is, knowing the law is really important. And I'd just like to talk more about who would coordinate this, how it would be administered, and how we would track it specifically. And there has to be one person or people that are responsible for it and who we can ask questions of or know who to contact if there's problems. And again, the reason why I don't want the homeowners to get fines yet is because I want them to first, I think a lot of them just don't realize that their contractors are in violation and I don't want it to feel punitive because I think they can help us. I don't think any homeowner really does want to be in violation of our laws. I don't think that's true for most contractors. And from what I've seen from being around, there are almost none that are not in violation. Most of them are still using the 77 decibel leaf blowers. Very few are using, and I don't even think the police know the difference, you know, this between the 67 or 65 and the 77. At some point, I think we should be thinking about moving towards no gasoline leaf blowers at all and working towards an idea of Newton being a quiet community in terms of all the noise impacts that really undermine our quality of life. And that's for another discussion. But I see this as part as just going towards a process towards the end of where we are successful in bringing some peace and quiet to our neighborhoods. So I'd like some more discussion about the specifics about how it's going to be administered and tracked, and how we would coordinate between ISD, the police, and the administration. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilor Leary. President Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see. I'll start back with my questions. So what if a landscaper is certified, gets registered and certified that they're using the proper kind of leaf blower, but then they don't? They have some that are proper and some that aren't. Do we account for that? If the landscaper just gets registered and then goes ahead and uses the wrong kind of leaf blower. I think you're muted, Ms. Councilor Baker.
I'm sorry. Ms. Lohler, the question was to us, what happens if a landscaper registers and still uses the wrong leaf blower? And
he would be in violation he'd be in violation of the other sections. They're separate. There's still violations that would be possible for any of the restrictions that are currently on board. There is just a new violation for operating the leaf blower without a permit. So if a registered leaf blower operator gets violations of any of the other restrictions, either the summer ban or the hours or using a non-compliant leaf blower, they can have notices of violation. And if they get enough of those, the process would eventually suspend or revoke their permit to use leaf blowers. And I do want to clarify, we cannot prevent them from doing all business in Newton. They would be able to do other landscaping or contracting work not involving the use of a leaf blower. That's the permit that would be revoked.
So what's the fine for using the wrong leaf blower?
It's the graduated fines, I believe, that are in the noise ordinance already. I'm very sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but I think
it's 100, 200, 300.
Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan.
100, yeah. 200, 300.
Okay.
Graduated, right.
Okay. It could happen.
Yeah, so, and that's, so just because they're registered doesn't give them a free pass.
They're
registered and that means they will comply. They are promising to comply with all the restrictions.
Yeah. And a reminder, as the registration process, that's when they receive the actual ordinance. They're sort of put on notice about what the ordinance is, and it enables them to be compliant.
Right. Yeah, but I can imagine a landscaper or two wanting to get the most out of all its equipment and using a non-compliant leaf blower every now and again in hopes that it just will work.
It happens. I see it. There's one landscaper I know, when I wander outside, puts away the old leaf blower and puts on the new one. I've just seen it personally, but I will say that the chief's team, I want to compliment the chief, because there's an incident in the neighborhood where I don't know if they got a fine, but I happened to drive by and there was a leaf blower sitting on the wall and these folks were actually raking leaves. It was really quite wonderful to see and so quiet. So I'm sure there was a conversation that went on between the officer and the team. And said, folks.
That's the feel-good story we all needed right now. Thank you, Councilor Baker.
Could I make a couple of comments?
Yeah, Chief, and I have another one for you, too.
Thank you. One of the issues now, I just looking, since January of 2017, we've gone to 1,228 calls up to the end of August of this year. And I talked to my crime analyst today, and, he has to read every report to get a disposition, so he's not caught up on it. But hopefully he will be soon, and I'll make sure he is. Now, one of the issues this year has been the virus, and officers have been minimizing their direct contact with people for what's considered to be the less serious issues. So, which this would certainly be classified. And a lot of these calls have been handled by telephone or just conversations that officers have had. Now, the other thing, as far as the attitude of, say, an officer on detail, a a lot of detail offices are retirees, which we don't want them taking enforcement actions. And we also have a lot of retirees who are out of town or campus police officers or state troopers that we really don't want, you know, unless it's a serious felony or something, to really get involved in a, you know, an infraction of the law. So that's possible. It could be a Newton officer. Now, if you look at it from a police kind of cultural standpoint, police officers see some pretty horrible things that would, I think, even shock members of this council. And, you know, if somebody has just come from a domestic violence call with a wife, or sometimes even a pregnant woman will have a broken nose, a jaw, or something like that, and then they go to a call and it's a leaf blower complaint, and the officer just says to himself, it's just hard for them to make that transition. And unless you've been in that position. So it's not, I'm not making an excuse. It's not right for an officer to display the wrong attitude. And maybe I have to work harder on getting officers, you know, because we are handling them right now, but I'm trying to explain why sometimes it officers do find it hard to enforce infractions, especially taking somebody to court after somebody's been arraigned for, you know, a state prison offense, and then they come in with leaf blowers and the judge is looking like, you know, why didn't you handle this out in the street? So I'm not saying that people shouldn't obey this law. And if a homeowner, you know, maybe this will give the homeowners an incentive, if depending on how you pass or not pass the ordinance, could give the certainly an incentive to the homeowner to make sure their contractors obey the law. But it's a very complicated issue for us. And you know, I don't think, and we certainly answer to the administration. We're not taking our marching orders from the task force, but we certainly answer to the mayor and to the city council. So thank you.
So Chief, the other thing I wanted to say, which I think is yours, is about, we talked about, well, post-COVID, I assume people will go back to work at some point. Right now, a lot of people are home, but prior to COVID and probably after COVID, there's a lot of people who aren't home. So if we end up giving the homeowner also a ticket or a fine, then, you know, I think the police would just leave it at the door. Is that something they can do, is just walk up to the door and leave it in the door?
Well, we could mail a citation or leave it in the door if that's allowed by the ordinance. I don't see why not. We do that occasionally on motor vehicle violations. It's really not the best practice, but it does happen sometimes. So I would just say, yes, we could do that.
Okay. Thank you. And let's see, this was for the ISD commissioner's not here, but you know, we had 25 and he wants it to be 100. I really, this is more for the finance committee than for us at Programs and Services, but I would want to see his work. You know, what is he putting into the fee, the registration fee, and you know, what all makes up the $100 fee, permit fee. So I would hope that before finance votes on that they get to see that. And the other thing is that, you know, if the police don't do this, I really can't imagine ISD would have the time to do this. I mean, we all have complaints from constituents who have, you know, they call and they ask the carpenter or the whoever needs to come and do an inspection. They're out in the field. They don't answer calls quickly enough. I can't imagine that the ISD folks are going to have the time to do these leaf blower calls. I just don't see it happening. And, you know, I think Constable Baker, I don't know if you're there or not, but you made a comment that in the winter they're less busy. I think that renovations go on all year long. I don't know, maybe you meant the police are less busy, but I think the ISD staff are working all year long on getting out to all these homes that have building permits that need updates. So
that's a fair comment. I didn't mean to imply they're not active. It's just that I think they do some permits around of January 1st, as I understand it. That's current practice.
Yeah, that's for people who are coming in to get their permits, but I don't see them going out in the field.
Oh, no.
Doing calls. Yeah, no, that's all. That was my only point.
Oh, no, I don't see that either.
Okay. Thanks. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Albright. Councilor Noel?
Thank you. So a couple of things. I mean, as I think about this ordinance, I very much feel the homeowners have to have some skin in the game. I've heard some people's concerns, and I was trying to think of the analogy that might make sense, because I do feel like the landscapers are the small businesses and the homeowners are really in the driving seat. And there's so many ways in which we vote or make our feelings or our values known through our spending habits, that this would be consistent with that. That if we value a community that's quieter or free from noise or free from gasoline exhaust, then we're going to hire, it's just like buying organic. If that's what you value, that's what you're gonna pay for. If you value a quieter community, you're going to pay and go the extra mile to make sure that your landscaping firm meets those requirements. The other analogy I was thinking of is when we have grandparents and nannies who violate the blue zone rules at our schools, we send a memo home to the family members saying, please inform your nanny, please inform your grandparents of how to properly use the blue zone. So I think about it very similarly. Now, having just gone through this very intense budget process, which I'm sure none of you can forget at this point, it wasn't that long ago, knowing how I voted in that budget process and the values that I expressed, it would be hypocritical of me to at this point say, well, the police are going to do this until we find something better. This is a really serious, thoughtful ordinance. And we are, you know, we had very intense conversations about what is the role of police, and to provide the police with this administrative task seems not only unnecessary, but unfair. And if ISD is not equipped to do it, then we need to figure out who is. But I think dumping this on the police department doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel fair, and feels in direct contradiction with the direction that we were going in the spring, or I would say the direction that I was going in and my voting pattern in the spring. So as long as the police are the ones who are gonna be monitoring this, even if it's just nights and weekends, I can't vote for this, but I would like to see the item go forward once we find out the proper organization to oversee this, that the homeowner has some skin in the game.
Thank you, Councillor Noel. Councillor Norton.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to keep from repeating what others have said, hopefully. I wanted to say I concur with Allison. It's important to know how this is going to be different, because the enforcement, I mean, it really has been a joke, and I don't say that to disparage anyone, but the police, too many of them don't take it seriously, including our former chief, which he stated in public and public programs and services meeting 4 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever that was. I concur with Julia and Brenda in terms of I think we should be getting the homeowners involved. Perhaps there could be ticketing both, you know, and make both aware. And we could do that at this public hearing. We could do that in other ways that we alert people. And that might really make the companies think, oh, I don't want to get my customers fined. And in terms of the importance of this, you know, to anyone who would say this is stupid, I felt this 4 years ago, obviously I still think it now. Everyone is, particularly now, everyone is home, everyone is stressed out, everyone has to hear this all the time. This ordinance really matters. In terms of who should do it, I do agree with Councillor Noel, I should say, not Brenda. We are having a conversation on police reform, including changing up things that they work on. And I would absolutely agree in terms of, like, yeah, you've just come from a domestic violence case and then you've got to deal with leaf blowers or, you know, shrubbery over the, you know, well, I guess that's ISD, whatever. Something that seems more frivolous. Well, maybe we shouldn't be having them do things that are frivolous. So I wanted to throw out, I don't know where parking meter enforcers, I mean, I believe that's weekend round. I mean, if that would be an option, or crossing guards or other people. I mean, crossing guards don't usually work on the weekend, but I do think we should think about additional people who could play that enforcement role. So Mr. Yo, if he's here, you know, maybe the administration could do some thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, we have certainly. There is no alternative at this point to have, if you want a speedy response to actually catch somebody leaf blowing with the incorrect leaf blower, there's no other entity in the city in the foreseeable future that has deployment of vehicles to quickly get to these scenes. And with the amount of staffing required to do that, you would need a new force of 12 to 16 people to cover shifts, vacations, weekends, everything. It's a huge effort to create a new code enforcement team or something like that. That's just the reality. There's no way we have other parts of city government, and we won't, given our budget situation, for some time. And you have to figure out, is that more important than sustainability or energy coaches or other things like that? Because you would need vehicles, you would need deployment, you would need to have people deployed around the city waiting to go to chase these things.
So then the other, then in terms of, let's see, look at my notes here. Then in terms of something that Ms. Lawler said, if they were caught, you know, fined and they couldn't use a leaf blower because we revoked that, why would they still be able to do, like, why if you've broken the law here, why couldn't we revoke your ability to do, you know, to do other work? Like, that seems like a big deal that we should treat as it's a big deal, particularly if we don't have manpower and woman power and non-gendered power to drive around the city. Would, you know, that's when we should raise, like, make the fine really serious, get people's attention a different way, so that maybe you wouldn't be caught that often, but if you were caught, it would really suck, so you'd rather not do that.
I don't think you can interfere with someone's ability to do business when the violation has nothing to do with any other portion of their business. This is a violation strictly to do with operation of leaf blowers. So I think it would be overreaching to say, if you violate the leaf blower portion, you may not do any other work in Boston pertaining to landscaping without a leaf blower or contracting or mowing or anything else that they have been complying with. So that's that I would really caution the city council against doing.
Okay, then what about, is there any reason that we would be not disclosing who had been fined? Could there be a list of companies that have been fined and have been violators, and then those who wanted to avoid those could?
I believe that would be a public record. And in any event, if they reached the point where their permit was revoked, they would be removed from the list. Mm-hmm. So that's something that the administration could think about.
And then just in terms of how this would work, and I am so sorry if this was said earlier, I had my son distracting me. So you get a permit and you'd get a certain number of permits for how many trucks you have. Is that, like, how would that, like, the nuts and bolts of this? Do we have that yet?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
So let's say you have three trucks. Would you get three labels or whatever they're called to be put on your truck?
Yeah, I think you would. And again, that would be a detail that would be administered by ISD. But yes, you would have to have that information and the permit. If you have three trucks, you wouldn't have three separate permits, but you would have three separate stickers or placards or whatever it is.
With your name and your
registration number on it.
With your company's name on it.
Would these be easily movable? If someone's looking quickly, you might not notice, like, oh, it's this company, but it's on this person's truck.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, we wouldn't want people to be giving them to each other to save money or something, to different companies.
You have to have your company's name on the permit. That's the only way to do this.
So it can't be permanently.
So you can't give it to your cousin's company to run his company.
I guess, you know, I'm just thinking about if it's something teeny tiny writing, then, you know what I mean, versus something very big and bold and
it's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's something that could be brought up with the ISD commissioner, because he's the one with the responsibility for developing the permits, the size of the permits, what's going to be on, et cetera. So that would be something for them to consider.
Okay, and I do want to go back to the parking. Aren't the parking enforcement people there all weekend?
There's a couple that work on the weekends, yeah.
But they must be not working much right now because we're not really enforcing much.
No.
But we hope to be working soon.
Since the 19th, they're enforcing many more of the parking ordinances. They work on Saturday, but not Sunday.
Okay. I mean, I know this isn't going to happen this season, I don't know, had a conversation with a few of them recently that I happened to chat with in the Austin Street parking lot, and they just seem so gung-ho about enforcing things that I was like, just kind of got my mind to working. So that's it for me. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilor Dorn. Councilor Humphrey, can I skip over you and get to people who haven't spoken yet, and then I'll come back to you? Councilor Greenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lawler, could you tell me how much Brookline charges for the permitting fee?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the Brookline ordinance.
Okay. So would this be...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah. And in some cases, I'm not certain that it's in their ordinance, but it would be in their regulations. So I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while since I looked at those.
Okay. I'm just curious how it would be comparable to other towns that have this ordinance. But I have to agree with Councillor Leary and Councillor Kalis that I don't feel that the homeowner should be fined. I spoke about this in previous program services committee meetings. I just feel that this issue is so controversial to begin with. The controversy that happened a few years ago when this first came out, that we really want the homeowners to be cooperative and engaged in a positive way in enforcing this and not become adversarial. So I think if we start fining the landscapers, fining the residents, we'll just have a bunch of angry people who don't want to follow the law or learn about the law. And it would just become a very combative environment instead of one of cooperation and, okay, let's sit down and solve this problem. So I agree. I don't think a homeowner should be charged for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Greenberg. Councilor Laredo. Councilor Laredo, welcome.
Well, I'm here because Councilor Crenshman, you told me you'd be getting to the schools an hour ago. So I've been grateful for the fact that I don't sit on programs and services. But I had to jump in because I really don't want to get involved in the details of what you should find or who you should find. I think you're all quite capable of debating that. But what Councillor Noel said and then Councillor Norton about the involvement of the police really struck me and I think is actually a very important issue for us to be thinking about carefully. I had a different view during our budget debates than Councillors Norton and Noel on the request to defund the police. But I made it quite clear that we need to be looking very carefully at what we're asking our police officers to do. And for those who supported defund the police concepts, I really find it really incompatible with the idea that we're going to send out armed officers to enforce leaf blower ordinances. And we talked about that and people spoke quite passionately about it during our finance debates. But we can't have it both ways. If we truly feel that police officers should be only dealing with more serious situations, potentially violent situations, trying to engage in cooperative relationships with the neighborhood, and then we send them out to enforce leaf blower violations, that seems to me quite incongruous. And so I really would urge us to think very carefully about who is doing the enforcement here, particularly at a time, unfortunately, in our country, when we're seeing disconnects between our law enforcement officers and the people they work for, why are we trying to encourage that even more? And I just really urge us to be very, very thoughtful about that. That doesn't mean that the leaf blower ordinance isn't a good idea. I think it is. I think the idea that folks can expect, particularly in a time of COVID, to have some peace and quiet in their neighborhoods is very important. But I think, as Councillor Greenberg just noted, how we do it is also very important. So I'm going to leave you all to this. I hope I get to stick around for the school discussion. But I really, really urge us not to be placing tasks on the police at the exact same time that, in this community and nationwide, we're criticizing our police department and asking them to do more with less or focus on different activities. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Councilor Laredo. Councilor Wright.
Thank you. I totally agree. I don't think the police should be enforcing it. And ISD and maybe a second person in ISD that will work some weekends and also parking enforcement. But I don't think we shouldn't stop this process because we haven't figured that out. I think we should continue on with this process. And maybe it comes up that on Sundays, there's no one there to enforce it. And whoever is, you know, blowing leaves on Sunday, at least it's not the whole entire city all in one that day. You know, they're going to get a pass if they're not following the rules. I personally do believe, like a lot of the other ones, counselors have said, that I think the homeowner should have a little bit in on this too. And I agree that the first time it's a warning, and personally, right now my kids are doing my lawn, but you know, if I had a lawn service going on and I got a warning, I would look up and see what other company or talk to my company and say, hey, you got to change your leaf blowers or I'm going to go elsewhere. And I think that would put more pressure on these companies to follow the rules. And having the first time as a pass and just a warning for the owner, and then they have, depending how often they do it, every 2 weeks or every week, another week or two to find something else, I think that is okay. But I think we should continue on the process, even though a lot of us don't agree that the police should do it, but it's gonna take some time. This is not gonna happen until the spring at the earliest. And yeah, I think we should just move on.
Thank you, Councilor Wright. I want to quickly say, as we go back to people for another round, that I would like to try and keep this to maybe 15 more minutes. We have two more serious discussions to have tonight and potentially lengthy items. So I would like to keep this to another 15 minutes. And then if folks want to vote, we can vote or hold whatever they want to do. But we do have a lengthy agenda tonight. Councilor Humphrey, thank you for indulging and letting others have their first shot at it. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually liked a couple of the comments that came in between. They were helpful to my follow-up remarks. So I agree with Chair Grossman that we're not going to be able to get this reform done in time for this autumn season, but I do hope we would be able to get it done by the spring season. But I think the biggest reason that we're still not there yet on this remains the enforcement issue. As Councilors Ryan and Noel have said, a number of us, including me, both on and off the committee, who overall favor reforming the leaf blower regulations, will not support it if we have not significantly modified the role of police in the enforcement. And this is, as Councilor Laredo has just argued, the position that is consistent with the objectives of the Defund NPD group, and that's the point that we've been making over the past several months in committee. Not to overstep into the arena of the police task force, but just to respond briefly to Mr. Yeo's points, I believe there are a lot of things in the city that we should be moving out of armed police officer enforcement jurisdiction and into a code enforcement team. And that doesn't mean sacrificing sustainability or other unrelated priorities of the community. It probably does mean replacing a dozen police officers with people who have a different unarmed role in our city. And as Councillor Norton said, taking some of those sort of more trivial, frivolous things off of the plates of the armed officers, although that's a discussion for another night. To respond to Councillor Leary's points, I really think that the scenario that she describes is what we're trying to do with the shared responsibility and the liability between the contractor and the homeowner. And that's the way it's drafted. I think Councillor Malachy noted that earlier. If the homeowner gets a warning, that is essentially education about the process, and they'll talk to the contractor to make sure it doesn't happen again, which helps to make this more self-enforcing. As Councillor Wright noted just now, if it does happen again for some reason, the homeowner receiving a fine probably means they're going to fire that contractor and look for someone new. That also addresses Councillor Leary's, somebody else's question about pushing repeat offender contractors out of doing business in our community. And to Councillor Noel's point, it's my
Councillor Norton.
Okay. And just to wrap up here, to Councillor Noel's point earlier in terms of analogies, I could be wrong, but it was my recollection that the snow shoveling ordinance is structured with some liability to the homeowner. And so that would bring this into alignment, which was one thing that we had discussed earlier in committee. So thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Harper. Councilor Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am also anxious to move ahead onto the other docket items. So I will be as brief as possible. And I appreciate that summary from Councilor Humphreys. And I also appreciated the comments from Chief Mintz. I think it's important to get the perspective of the police. I also just wanna say, if we want to have this enforced, if we take the police out of it, we will not have any enforcement. And that's just practically how it's gonna be, unless over the years we figure out a whole nother fund of money to do that. And that's why, again, why the public hearings, why discussion of stakeholders, why getting the message down from the chief down and from the administration down that this is something that's important to people, putting it in water bills, putting it in tax bills, information for homeowners, putting it on the Green Newton website, on the city website. We're a low crime, affluent community, and quality of life is important to people. So I think that's certainly in the part of the role of the police. I'm cognizant of not putting the police in a situation where they'd be adversarial. And I think we, by not fining the homeowners, by having the police have more positive interactions and putting them in an educational role, even before I had asked if the police could have a simple card or flyer that they could actually, if they saw a contractor working, they could just hand it out to them just as letting them know this is our law now. So I'm all for being proactive, positive, and getting the message out on every channel possible, because even if the police are involved as they are now, enforcement will be sketchy. It will not be a priority. I understand there are other things that the police have to do. At the same time, people deserve to have the laws enforced that we have. Otherwise, I'm in favor of completely repealing the leaf blower law, because it's been a colossal waste of time up until this point. And we either take it seriously or we don't.
Thank you, Councilor Leary. Councilor Baker, it'll be good to hear from you tonight, please.
What a surprise. So let me just summarize what I'm hearing. And I just want to be clear that, again, part of the attempt here is to take some burdens off of the police. But I think that there's some drafting work that we could do, and also potentially, I'm not sure a public hearing is in order, Mr. Chairman, but if the Finance Committee is comfortable with the sense that $100 is a fee that seems to make sense, if we could at least get the sense of the Finance Committee about that issue, then we can take the matter back into Programs and Services to work on the balance of the ordinance and perhaps have an opportunity for comment. I will say that
Councilor Baker, let me just interrupt your point a sec. Ms. Lawler, can you put yourself on mute? We're hearing an echo of the proceedings. Thank you.
I'm sorry. So I think if the Finance Committee is comfortable with the at least sense that $100 is a fee will assist the administration of this process, including the education that we've heard is going to be important, then if that sense of the committee can be gained, that would help the Programs and Services Committee. Then we could take the item to the Programs and Services Committee and work more on some of these details and some of the philosophy that members of the committee and others have articulated. So if I could make a procedural suggestion at the end, as I did at the beginning in response to you, I know that's a surprise, Chairman, that the Finance Committee, if they're willing to vote the fee, but not necessarily they're not supporting the ordinance, this is only the fee part, then we can take, and I would move hold on the other item, and then talk a little bit about a process that I would recommend to the committee to try and move forward on this so that we could have something in place for the spring if we can get there, so that we don't lose this opportunity.
Just to be clear though, Councilor Baker, which fee are you talking about? Are you talking about the registration fee?
The registration fee.
And not the separate fee on commercial landscapers?
No, the registration fee is on the commercial landscapers. There's a fine for violating it, which is part of...
I apologize, I meant fine.
Okay, no, I think that both are the finance pieces, but we're saying, now we may say that as we get back into Programs and Services, there ought to be a warning first and explicit about that. But I think the point is that once you have been warned, that operating without a registration ought to be a significant number so that it's not just a trivial business expense and you just say, you know, I'll just pay that and keep paying it and keep paying it and just add it to the cost of the landscape bill that they hand on, in effect. So
what you're saying, your hope is to ask for the registration fee to be approved by finance tonight, the $100 registration to essentially put the commercial landscapers on notice.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
I'll move something in programs and services after.
Understood.
Can I ask a question about that?
Go ahead, Councilor Russell.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just procedurally want to understand where we're going here. Councilor Baker, can you try one more time to explain to me why it would be helpful to move the process forward if finance was comfortable with that fee tonight? And the reason I'm asking is responding to some others' comments, including President Albright, who I think rightfully pointed out we haven't seen any backup or documentation from ISD that led to that number. I mean, I certainly take Ms. Lawler's word to heart that $100 probably doesn't really scratch the surface of what's involved from their perspective, but it would be helpful to me to understand why, in your view, us being comfortable with $100 tonight helps move the rest of the process forward. I'm all about being able to move this forward appropriately, but I'm not getting the sense from my committee members that they are. And of course, I defer to all of you to speak for yourselves, but.
Let me be clear. I thought we could, if the fee was something people were comfortable with, it could be then moved out. Your committee would be done. It wouldn't be done with the item because it still would have to be over in programs and services to be finished up. But if finance wants to have another meeting on the fee, that's fine with me. I was just trying to save your time, not my time.
In that case, I would just ask quickly, once we get through the other comments, if we could take a couple minutes to hear from members of the Finance Committee on their comfort level or not about...
It's really a matter of saving your time, whether you want to deal with this again.
But we do have to deal with it again about the fine, no matter what.
I'm not sure you do. That was part of the... I did leave that to Ms. Lawler, but... My objective is to save everyone time of this body. So if you want to hold on to it and talk about both issues later again, it's fine with me. I was just thought you might want to move this.
No, but believe me, I'm all about efficiency where we can achieve it and get the job done well. But Ms. Lawler, wouldn't we have to have another meeting anyway about the fine if we don't vote the fine tonight?
Well, yeah, if you don't vote the fine, you would have to have another meeting. Because Finance Committee needs to weigh in on fees and fines.
Yeah.
Okay, in that case, okay. I renew my request to hear from members of the Finance Committee about their comfort level on any numbers this evening.
I also don't want to interrupt, but I also just want to clarify if you're talking about the order of voting on the item. If you're talking about the fine or the fee, if this is something that programs and services would have to vote on before finance can take the final vote on it or not. Because I recall for some of the other joint items we have, that the other committee has to vote to set the fee beforehand, and then finance has to vote after, if that makes sense.
Yes, Nathan, that's a good point. You're right.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, we have so many other items.
We do. I just want to, I appreciate that. I just want to hear from Mr. Yeo. I think Mr. Yeo wanted to talk a little bit about the registration, and then I think we'll probably...
Very quickly, I think the registration is very important, and I think this really could help the program achieve some of the goals in reducing the impact on the police department. So I do think, though, we need to take back and talk with ISD about the exact dollar figure. I think possibly it could be less than $100. And I think we're going to need to, I know, Councillor Baker, you want to keep moving forward on this, but
I'm happy to wait.
Wait, and we should talk a little bit more about really what are the costs of printing out the stickers and handing out the registrations. I do think this is a very valuable thing for us to move forward with, though. So we need to keep up the momentum on it.
That's fine. And in the interest of time, then, I would be happy, Mr. Chairman, if when you get to programs and services to move hold, and the finance committee, someone on finance wants to move hold, we can do that and then talk in the programs and services committee about process.
I think that's a good idea. I think I see a few more hands up, but my suggestion is, since it's almost 9 o'clock already, that we do move hold on both of these items, and then separately the committees can figure out how to proceed forward, especially given all the feedback we've had tonight. Is that okay with folks? Can I, Councilor Baker, President Albright,
Councilor Albright? I want to put something on the table for later Please. Conversation, and not for discussion tonight, but I would just ask the chief for a conversation later. I had a conversation with the chief of police in Arlington not long ago, maybe 3 years ago, about the snow shoveling ordinance and the fees that and fines that went with that. And he said that if the community wants it, then that it's community policing. And I ask my officers to do it, because community policing is what we do. So I think in the context of understanding what community policing means, and whether it means this kind of enforcement or not, I think, and this goes along with the whole discussion about what the police responsibilities are going into the future, but I would love to have that conversation with you at a later meeting to understand whether you think it's appropriate or not, as part of community policing, to have this as a responsibility for the police or not. So that's for later, but thank you very much for that.
Thank you, President Albright. With that, the items for programs and services are 49-20 and 49-20 parens 2. Before finance, it's just 49-20 parens 2. So, in programs and services, do I have a motion to hold on both those items?
I move to hold.
Thank you, Councilor Ryan. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. So we got a hold on both of those, Councilor Grossman.
In finance, do we have a motion to hold?
I'm happy to make that motion. I just wanted to ask quickly, though, to Councilor Baker, if it would be helpful for the Finance Committee to do like some kind of a straw poll or something like that that can be changed later, in terms of you having the confidence to move forward to the next step in our committee. Well, I'm on both committees, but you know what I mean.
I think it's the administration, if I can comment, that may need to get back to us when I hear Mr. Yeo indicate.
Okay.
But it would be, I think that's what I'm hearing from him, that he'd like to have a chance to clarify what the numbers should be. So I think I'd rather defer that until he can give that back. And I hope maybe we can bring back something that will be clear enough that everybody will be able to then decide what to do next. But outreach is important too.
Okay, that's totally fine with me. I'll move hold in Finance Committee.
Okay, thank you. And Councilor Humphrey, my mind was initially to straw poll as well, but I just unfortunately don't think that we're ready this evening. So appreciate the motion for hold. All those in favor of hold, if you could raise your little blue hand, please. Okay, let's see. I see 5-0. So we will hold it. Thanks very much for the thought.
May I just say, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time of everybody. I would just ask if I could confer, if it's agreeable to the members who are here, to confer with the chair and Mr. Yeo about how to bring this forward at the next round. Obviously, we can't do that tonight, but I'd hope we can do something relatively expeditiously.
Yep. The work goes on. The cause endures. We will keep working. Thank you, Councilor Baker. Councilor Grossman, thank you. I think you guys are free to stick around, but I think, I don't know if you want to adjourn your meeting.
Is there a motion to adjourn the Finance Committee meeting? Let's do it formally. Councilor Malachy, all those in favor, we'll take an aye rather than blue hands on this one. Aye. Okay. We're adjourned. Thank you, Finance Committee members, for joining on what is not our usual night. And I want to thank the Programs and Services Committee for having us, as well as all the members of the administration who are here tonight. I know this has been a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of thinking, and we appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilor Grossman. And I hope that Jack enjoyed what he saw tonight, including Ms. Lawler's cat. Two special guests of honor.
A lot of questions about who you are.
All right, the next item on our agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, they have both decided to join the meeting. They've been good for so long, but that's terrific. About it. Rosie and Ralphie.
Cats are welcome to participate remotely due to allergy concerns of some folks. But okay, the next item on the Programs and Services agenda is item 397-20. This was filed by the President of the Council, and it is a request for updates related to public health in the Newton Public Schools. Ms. Walsh, are you here? And Commissioner Youngblood, you're here as well? Terrific.
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I assume you just logged on 5 minutes ago and you didn't subject yourself to the last 2 hours, but if you did, you know, welcome anyway.
Nice to be here.
So I am happy to turn it over to you. Did you guys want to provide an update on how things are going and how the public health is looking for the return to school?
Sure. Well, so just to be sure, I think you all know Deputy Commissioner Linda Walsh, who I'm joined by tonight. And we don't have a significant update from the last time that we were before you, but we do have, you know, 5 or 6 weeks now of in-person school for some of our students under our belt. And I would say that I'm tentatively optimistic because our public health mitigation pillars appear to be working in that we do not have any evidence to date of in-school transmission of the virus. And that's, of course, what we want to be able to keep our schools open is to be able to have our students there. We know that we will have people who are unknowingly positive for the virus come into school. And what we want is to have our schools designed so that people can be in them and they still won't have the virus transmitted when that happens. And so, you know, it's a good start. And we really want to say that we continue to support in-person school. It's a big priority for the health department. We're health and human services. So we've been working on mental health and social emotional needs of our youth, our families, our entire community for forever. And we know how important it is to have our kids in school. We also know that we have a balancing act that we need to do this year since we're in the middle of a pandemic. So we're pleased that we think we have a mode for doing that in-person school. And we really are hopeful that our schools will move forward with in-person for students at all of the levels.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yep. So I think it was at the joint meeting of the school committee and the city council. I think I asked you, I said, you know, is there any public health reason why we shouldn't be returning to schools? And you said no. And it sounds to me like what you're saying tonight is you sort of stand by that, and all the evidence we're seeing from the folks who have returned to school is a demonstration, at least, that the measures that we have chosen to take and are taking have been effective in eliminating, if not reducing, if not eliminating, transmission of the virus in the school setting.
Right. Yes, okay. Absolutely. I wouldn't say that anything that we can do will eliminate that possibility, but certainly we are working to reduce that risk to the best of our ability.
Sure. Let me see if we got some questions here. Councillor Norton. Councillor Norton.
Sorry, that must have been from before when I was voting.
Oh. Okay. Okay, let's make sure that your vote is counted then. Councillor Laredo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Youngblood, Ms. Walsh, always good to see you. Thank you. I had submitted a number of questions in advance through the chair to you, Commissioner Youngblood. So let me try to go through those if I could. And the first is, who exactly is providing medical advice to the health department? And how were these advisors, regarding COVID, of course, and how were these advisors selected?
Sure. So, you know, I think I want to start out, Counselor, and those are great questions. I think I want to start out by acknowledging the knowledge that we have within the health department. You know, within our senior members of our team, we actually have decades of both public health experience and credentials. So we certainly begin in-house. The way that Massachusetts is set up, and many of you know this, but some of you might not, is that the state provides the sort of deep bench of medical expertise for all of the 351 cities and towns. And since COVID has started, so we're always in touch with the state, whether it's COVID or not. When we have a issue or a question that requires an epidemiologist, for example, we're not expected to have one of those on staff or to hire one. We turn to the state and we can have them work with us on those kinds of issues. They get assigned to particular kinds of concerns or cases that we have, and then we can also request that help. So we talk to the state twice a week now, and we have particular folks on their team assigned to us for particular sort of thorny issues. In addition to that, we've been working very closely with Newton Wellesley Hospital since the pandemic started. We always work with Newton Wellesley, but we've been working very closely with them, and they've helped us design some of our initiatives. We always have, as we are required by regulation and pleased to have, our school health physician who's been with us for quite a few years now, Dr. Sadler. And then in the last few months, we have hired Dr. Dori Zalesnik to be a particular medical advisor to the health department. As you know, Dr. Zalesnik, is both an infectious disease doctor and has many, many years of experience working in public health, on the school committee, and in the executive office. So she really understands the context as well as the medical science, and that intersection is extremely important when you're trying to do this work.
Well, I know Dr. Zalesnik well since we served in the school committee together for 8 years, and she also served our administration, Mayor Warren. She's certainly exceptionally well qualified. I do have to say, though, that other communities seem to have gathered advisory groups of specialists, particularly with expertise in infectious diseases and COVID. You know, one of the things I love about Newton is when I go to a back to school night or I talk to other folks, we have not only, you know, really smart people here, we have the leading experts in the world in this stuff, in this community, many of whom have volunteered to work and help us for free. So I guess what I'd urge you, Commissioner, is reach out to 8 or 10 of those leading specialists at our leading teaching institutions. Just ask them to serve in an advisory group, work with you and Dr. Zalesnik, because more is better, particularly when you have this incredible wealth of opportunity. So I just will, while I appreciate the in-house expertise that you have in the department, when we're dealing with a crisis such as COVID, I really, really, really would urge you to try to convene those folks, get them together, share with them what you're doing and not doing, and let them and give you some guidance, because we're going to have a long path ahead of us. And I think that'd be beneficial to the community. It also, I think, might be reassuring to the community to know that we're not afraid to reach out to the experts within our midst. And tap them. And like I said, any of us on this council know the number of exceptionally talented people we have. So I did hear you respond to Chair Krinsman to make it clear that there are no health reasons currently we can't get back to in-person learning. And so I'm very glad to hear that. Obviously, I understand that may change if yes. COVID changes. One final question. What are our neighboring communities, Needham, Wellesley, Lexington? Do they have health advisory committees? Do they have any people advising them?
You know, I'm not aware of what all of our neighboring communities are doing. I think, you know, folks are organized differently and they have sort of different level, the way their departments are set up or are set up differently. So I'm not actually familiar with that.
Respectfully, it might be worth a call or two if they've been able to convene successfully groups of you know, experts to give them guidance. I'm just trying to expand the talent pool here. You have a very difficult task. No one envies that. I just want to make sure we're utilizing the expertise we have in this city to the best extent we can. So I'm all set. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Thank you, Councilor Laredo. Councilor Baker. You're still on mute, sir.
Commissioner, one of the issues that has been on our minds is just the importance of potentially surveillance testing. I know that's been under consideration, but I wondered if you could update us on that. In my university, I get tested through the Broad Institute and they turn it around in 24 hours. And now that the state has got the tents up in Framingham, you can go get tested for free. And that was about a 24-hour turnaround for my wife just recently. Can you comment about surveillance testing as a way of trying to keeping the virus at bay, so to speak?
Sure. So, you know, I do think that surveillance testing is, you know, one of the very important tools that can be used as we try to sort of manage this virus and continue to move forward. And I will also say that I think at this point, with the numbers the way that they are in Newton and in Newton, that really surveillance testing as a sort of essential or required element to opening our schools would not be something that I would recommend. However, I would say that, you know, we are continuing to review what's becoming available. And I do think that, you know, there will likely be a time when surveillance testing becomes more logistically and financially feasible, and then it may be something that we really want to consider. In terms of the Stop the Spread tents that you mentioned, and I'm glad that you did, those are the tents that the state puts up and, you know, it becomes available to, you know, sort of free testing for folks. I think that one of the things, and I'll just kind of put this out to counselors in case anyone wants to take up the cause, I would really like to see a Stop the Spread tent closer to Newton. I don't think that it has to be in Newton, but I do think that the closest one is Framingham, and we really do want to encourage, there's lots of places to get tests, testing is available, but that's a very convenient way for our residents to be able to be tested, and I'd love to see one closer. Waltham is red, and some of our other neighboring communities, meaning that they have higher incidence rates. And so I think that that would be something that we could bring up in our conversations with our friends at the state and encourage for some more Stop the Spread tents, and particularly closer to Newton. Linda, I don't know if you want to add anything.
I think that's perfect pitch, and I think there's people here that could really help in the chorus. I know our commissioner has brought those up on our state-level calls many times. As she's mentioned, we do have joint meetings with the Department of Public Health, and we would really like a Stop the Spread test in the Metro Boston area. It's, as you stated, Counselor, it's free to all Massachusetts residents. There's just no barriers other than time, because I imagine you had to wait a bit. Echo that.
No, there was one at the Chestnut Hill Mall, and I don't know what's happened to that. That was a private provider, but...
Yes.
Yeah, but I think that's... I hope that that could be pursued. Thank you.
Yep, we're working on it.
You all set, Councilor Baker?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Wright.
Hi, I'm kind of piggyback on Councilor Baker. Is there some way we can establish a quick turnaround testing site for Newton employees? There are complaints that the PCP offices can't handle the requests and the results are delayed at Newton Wellesley Hospital. actually, unfortunately, my family has a lot of experience with these tests where everyone has been tested between 2 and 9 times. And at Newton Wellesley Hospital, if you're in the ER, you get the quick test and that's good. But going outside or now into this separate building, you sometimes take a day or two to do it. Going to, you know, stop the spread sites due to, like you said, some of my family members have gone there, a few hours of waiting in line in the car before you can do it. Fortunately, when I have done it at Waltham at AFC, I've gotten my test results before I got home. I mean, it really, really differs. And actually, one family member, it took a week for him to get his test results. So it's been kind of frustrating. And is there some way that you can coordinate or get something where there's a quicker turnaround for Newton employees? Because Newton Wellesley Hospital isn't right, really meeting. You know, I had a procedure that I had to go through them to get a test before I had, you know, and it took a day or two to get the results. So it is kind of frustrating. So you said you're doing something, but what are you doing to help, you know, further this process?
So the Stop the Spread tents are run by the state, and the state chooses their locations based on where they think that the greatest need is based on the COVID prevalence in the area. So, you know, we have some, you know, we have the ability to continue to lobby for that, but it isn't something that we can decide locally, like, oh, we're going to stand this up. It certainly isn't something that any local jurisdiction would have the bandwidth to sort of stand up on their own. So it's something that we would have to partner with. I think everybody has sort of universally had this experience of, you know, going to different testing sites, if you've been tested, going to different places, and they vary, and they don't just vary depending on the site, they actually vary at different times. Different labs get backed up at different moments in time, so you can have, you know, a time when, say, that AFC urgent care had, like, really fast turnaround, and then other times where not so much. And so, you know, unfortunately, a lot of those things are somewhat out of our control, other than being able to, which we do, stay very on top of where are the tests available and how do you get them. And I know that people don't always want to go through their primary care, and that some primary cares feel overwhelmed. But from our perspective in terms of health, if you're symptomatic, we really do want to encourage people to start with their medical home. I mean, that's the person who's going to be best equipped to not only sort of order you the test, but then work with you through the whatever those results are.
And I would just say, I think you first started by talking about employees. We have put out to all employees exactly what the commissioner said. You should go through your PCP. And for some people, that's so easy. And for other people, it isn't. And we always encourage them to call us. If it's a school and it's a staff person in a school, talk to your school nurse. If it's a resident, if it's someone who works in our, you know, City Hall, in our public works, in our employee side, to talk to us at the health department. We want to make sure people find access to testing. So we ask them to go through PCP first. Lots of times that works out. If it doesn't work out, we ask them to come to us. And we do have an ability. If people are underinsured, uninsured, have difficulty testing, don't speak the language, there, if there's a barrier to getting tested, in particular for our Newton residents and our employees, we work with them. Our public health nurses work with them to connect to testing. As the commissioner said, once that test is taken and it goes off to whatever lab they use, the genie's out of the bottle. It is amazing. Sometimes it comes back really quickly, and other times, like you mentioned, Counselor Wright, it's 4 or 5 days later. So there's other factors that are involved there. But that's how we work really hard to make sure that people have access to testing and then stay quarantined and isolated until you get your test results back.
And okay. I forgot to mention, Councillor Wright, that we, and this is what Linda was referring to, that we did establish a formal MOA with Newton Wellesley Hospital for that safety net testing. So if there is somebody with those significant barriers, whether they're a resident or an employee, we can easily and quickly facilitate them to get a test at Newton Wellesley Hospital. So we are glad to have that available for those that are struggling.
Yeah, it's a turnaround time too. That's an issue too.
Yeah, that one, as Linda mentioned and I mentioned, we don't have any control over. We're not a lab.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Wright. Councillor Noel.
Commissioner Youngblood, I want to thank you for coming on tonight and speaking to us. I just want to ask for some clarity because we're getting, as you can imagine, maybe you're getting them as well, just a barrage of emails from constituents about the schools. And I'm not clear, and maybe there's other people that would be helpful to understand too, the role that your office played in terms of advising the decision makers on the opening or closing of schools and how you interface with the mayor, the school committee, Superintendent Fleischman, you know, and what your role is in the decision-making process.
Sure. So, well, as you know, I work for the mayor, so I spend a great deal of time with her, and, you know, I'm consistently and perhaps constantly updating her on sort of where we are, all of the work around COVID, moving forward, our various initiatives, keeping her apprised of all of the issues that are plentiful right now as we've been working through this pandemic for many months. Our role in this with the school department is one that I would call collaborative. So in Newton, the school nurses work for the health department. So in order to have, you know, and school nurses obviously always have a very important role. We love our school nurses. But this year they have an incredibly vital role. And so, you know, where we oversee those nurses and therefore establish the kinds of policies and protocols, how are they going to do their work, what are they going to do when young people or staff are in the building, maybe they felt great when they got up in the morning, but they developed symptoms during the day, right? All of those things are health department, that's our work. And so it was important that we therefore work on sort of both what are we going to do in terms of our nursing staff, and then also we provided at the school administration's request, but we always assumed that we would do it, some guidance around sort of what are those risk mitigation pillars, how could you open schools and mitigate the risk of viral transmission. We know that our school department is very, very capable and they get information from lots of different sources, and that's wonderful. And so we're one of the people that gave guidance to them. But ultimately, while how our nurses manage things in the building is up to us, the opening of schools is not up to us. That would be a school committee and a school administration decision.
Excellent, that's helpful. Do you mind if I ask a follow-up question, Chairman Crinsman?
Please go ahead.
So, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Commissioner Youngblood. I just think there's so much misinformation out there, and people are coming to me and saying, you know, this happened and that happened, and I wasn't in every meeting. I don't know how it happened. But so my question is, as the school committee's working to think of a plan forward for the schools, will Health and Human Service be the deciding factor in what the preventative measures will look like in terms of like how far apart the desks will be, who's going to wear a mask, how often hands are washed? Are you guys the word on that, or will that policy be created somewhere else?
So those policies were designed by the health department. They already exist. So there's a health manual that's on the MPS website that was drafted by the health department. So those are our guidelines that we recommended to the school committee and to the school administration that they chose to accept and use as their sort of parameters.
Mm-hmm. All right, and just, so what was the recommendation about the desks? Because I've heard that it's 3 feet, 6 feet. What was that recommendation?
Yeah, lots of conversation about this. So as you know, or I'm assuming all of you know, since for many months now, public health officials all across the country, not in Newton, all across the country have been recommending 6 feet of physical distance between individuals as an important tool, not the only tool, but an important tool in reducing the risk of viral transmission, right? So those signs are everywhere. That's become sort of a commonly known measure that you can take. You know, along with washing your hands and wearing your face coverings, that's one of the measures. In the summer, the Department of DESE came out with a recommendation that said that school districts should aim for 6 feet, but that they could have as little as 3 feet in between desks. So they felt that was, and they had many, you know, very smart, capable, credentialed people on that advisory. So that was their recommendation. I think that, you know, we discussed it and felt like it's not just about getting kids back in school. It's really about helping them to stay there. And if we have viral transmission in our school buildings, that's the thing that will make us have to shut down. I mean, there's other things that could, if we have it in the community in overwhelming amounts, then that will make it too. But that's one of the things that makes it have to shut down. So what we're looking for is some measures where we can have our students in the building, but when there's a positive case, and we have already had people who were infectious unknowingly come into our buildings during their infectious period, we don't want there to be close contacts of a positive case in our school buildings. If you're a close contact, which means that you're closer than 6 feet for more than 10 minutes, then you're A, going home for 14 days, regardless of what tests you take. And frankly, you're just at risk of contracting the virus and spreading it. And so we really want to think about, is there a sustainable way to open our schools and keep them open? We felt that the 6 feet of distance was the best measure. Interestingly, I don't know of any other district in Massachusetts that chose to go with the 3 feet of distance. Doesn't mean they're not out there, but I haven't spoken to any of them yet. So to my knowledge, the vast majority of districts went with the public health principle of 6 feet as they moved to open.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Noel. President Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Youngblood, I think you just answered my question, because we get so many questions from parent community about the 3 feet versus the 6 feet. And I know so many of our neighbors are fully hybrid at all three levels. And I was wondering whether the other districts are going with the 3 feet or the 6 feet.
None that I'm aware of. I did actually ask this question of DESE, and I wasn't able to get an answer from them. So there may be a district out there that is using the 3 feet, or that's just using less than six. And we didn't sit, and in our guidelines, it says, you know, we really think there should be a goal of 6 feet. Not necessarily that you had to measure, you know, it had to be exactly 6 feet. So I don't think that there's a little bit of room there. And certainly the school administration could decide to make a different plan as they set up their schools. But our recommendation from the health department, which is consistent across most districts and public health officials that we're hearing across the country, is 6 feet really reduces the risk of viral transmission. I don't know, Linda, did you want to add anything?
No, I think you said it perfectly. You know, it is about transmission of disease and mitigating that possibility for transmission, because as the commissioner has already stated, you'll never be able to eliminate the risk, but you can certainly put those pillars in of good hand hygiene, always wearing a face covering, and keeping that distance so that if someone happens to be infectious, it stops there and you don't have more people transmitted that virus, especially in a school setting. As I think the commissioner has said, our goal is to not only make it available to open schools, but to keep schools open, because that really is going to be the success of this story of living with COVID. We know COVID's going to be here for months to come. If we can put these public health mitigation factors in all of our workplaces and schools, we hope that we can live with COVID until we get an effective vaccine.
One thing that might be useful for the parent community and for us as well would be to, if somebody has the time, to just call the 8 or 10 neighboring communities that are fully hybrid and say, do you have the goal of 6 feet or do you do 3 feet? Just so we can say, you know, with certainty, everybody's doing 6 feet, so let's put that to bed.
Well, we do know that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, President, but we do know that our immediate neighbors are doing that greater distance, because our nurse, our school nurse leader, Ruth Hoshino, is on regionally with all of the nurse leaders, sort of not all of them, but with many of the nurse leaders locally, and all of them went with that greater distance.
Needham, Wellesley, Weston, Lexington, all of them.
Yes.
Okay, that's great to know, and I think that it's helpful for me to know that anyway. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm going to come back to Councilor Laredo in 1 second. If I could just ask one question first, if you don't mind, Councilor Laredo.
You're the chair. You're in charge.
I try to defer to people and let them ask their questions. Commissioner Youngblood, what I wanted to ask you was, you spoke very eloquently earlier about all of the factors that went into all of the recommendations that you made. For a number of reasons. And I think you also mentioned the social and emotional benefits of students being in the schools. So I guess my question is, the trajectory of this virus, what we're learning about the virus is obviously evolving over time, and we're all sort of reassessing all of the recommendations we're making. My question is, especially factoring in the social and emotional benefits of being in school, are you contemplating revising any of the recommendations you've made? At what point would you revise the recommendations you've made? And what factors do you think would tend to maybe alter your recommendation on, for example, the 6 feet versus, you know, more wiggle room to come down 5 or 4 feet if it allows for more kids in schools?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that the exciting part about the pandemic is that we are constantly reviewing everything that we're doing.
Exciting is an interesting word. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's late. And looking closely at, you know, what's working in other places, what are the studies showing, what's the data showing. We very much want to both manage the virus locally so that we can protect our community to the best of our ability, so that we don't see high rates, we don't have more significant numbers of deaths. We've already had losses in our community that are very significant. So, you know, at the same time, we recognize that, as Linda pointed out, and all of you well know, we got to live with this for a while to come. And we don't want living with it to mean that everybody is sort of sacrificing so much of the rest of their well-being. So trying to strike that balance is what we're working toward all the time. And so I guess that's my long-winded way of saying, of course, we definitely want to continue to do that, continue to look at the recommendations. It's not something that I would suggest changing at the moment, but that doesn't mean that, you know, a couple of months from now, we might not be having a very different conversation. I think that's the way things have gone so far, and it's the way I expect them to be moving forward.
Yeah, I think a number of us are concerned that, especially a couple months from now, we will be having very different conversations. Councilor Laredo.
So just briefly, Commissioner, you referred earlier to you or we when you responded to the questions about the 6 feet versus 3 feet. Could you expand on who that we is?
Sure. Sorry. I always refer to everything in the we because in our department, we work so closely with each other. And so that's just a habit of mine. But the primary conversations around the 3 feet versus the 6 feet really happened within our department. And with we also consulted with our school health physician as well over the summer.
So I guess I'm not an expert here, and I don't want to wade in 3 feet versus 6 feet. But given that DESE did come out with a different recommendation, to me, that's a good example of where it would have been beneficial to have an outside advisory group of really top-notch infectious disease COVID folks who can, if they verify the decision that you make, then I think you bolster the basis for that decision. If they conflict or they give you pause on that, that may be a way of thinking it through. I actually just think that kind of advisory group, when you're making those critical medical decisions, because notwithstanding the tremendous expertise I think you all have, and I think you do a great job in your department, you know, like I said, we have particular medical expertise dealing with COVID in the community, and I would just hope we take advantage of that, at least going forward. It is good to hear, as Councilor President Albright said, that at least in the neighboring communities, the 3 feet versus 6 feet apparently has not been an impediment for any of them to get back to in-person learning at all three levels. So I'm very glad to hear that, and that's encouraging. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Councilor Wright. Councilor Wright.
I just want to follow up quick with President Albright. So my sister's a teacher in Weston. And they're doing, for elementary school, they're doing 6 feet apart, but they're bringing back the full class, but their classes are only 17 or 18 in K to five. They also have air purifiers, one or two in every classroom. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think they're doing 4 half days a week. And then they have their specials in the afternoon.
I'm sorry, just a comment. Okay.
That was helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Councilor Wright.
I am not seeing any other hands up at the moment. So let me take this opportunity to thank you, Commissioner Youngblood. I know you have some scheduling issues that are going on. And so I do thank you for taking some time to come be with us tonight. I think you probably spent more time with us tonight than you had originally anticipated, not because of your item. But again, I thank you. I think we would probably love to, you know, keep a dialogue open with you so that we can keep track of this. I know the City Council is taking the schools issue very seriously and looking very closely at what it's going to take to reopen the schools. And so I think you're a big piece of that conversation. And again, I thank you for coming tonight. Thank you, Ms. Walsh, as well. And with that, I would accept any motion from the committee if folks are looking to hold this, maybe to have another discussion.
Yeah, motion to hold because we asked for another conversation in a month's time.
Thank you, Madam President. So Councilor Albright has moved hold. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And any abstentions? Okay, so we will hold that. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Youngblood. Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
And we have one last item on our agenda, which is item 390-20. This is a request for a discussion on athletic field rental fees. I believe that we have been joined by Commissioner Banks again. Welcome back, Commissioner Banks. I know you provided a bunch of materials in the packet, which hopefully everybody reviewed. But if you want to kick off this item, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Crinsman and City Council members, and hopefully I can keep you awake for just a little bit longer this evening. That was a great discussion with our health commissioners. They've been such a help for our department, leaning in and working with them as well, so I enjoyed listening to their updates. So I wanted to come tonight, and I thank you for the invitation, because this was actually brought forward to me to invite me here to speak about our athletic field fee schedule.
And before I get too deep into the fee schedule that we have that's included in your packet, I just wanted to introduce to this committee that we have a subcommittee that we've reformed. It's a subcommittee of our Parks and Recreation Commission. And this subcommittee will be working on a larger comprehensive focus for the athletic fields that will include reviewing the field fees, but will be a larger effort beyond that that will also include looking at field projects, how to improve our athletic fields, how we schedule our athletic fields, and how we maintain our athletic fields. So they certainly have a wide scope of work to begin to tackle. The subcommittee is comprised of three members of our Parks and Recreation Commission, and we have started to hold public meetings where we will invite stakeholders to participate and provide feedback to this subcommittee. Stakeholders for this group will include athletic users such as our youth sport groups, our school athletic department, the recreation programs for the city, and other users for our fields. The goal of this group is going to be to assess the needs of these stakeholder groups and see how we are meeting those needs and identify and propose some solutions to better meet those needs if we can. We typically don't rent our fields out over the winter months, although I understand there might be a late winter season with some of the COVID changes that have happened to our athletic operations as well. But this will give our committee some time to evaluate the fees and compare those to other communities, as well as look to our own field users to determine what is needed for the fee structure. We want to make sure that any fee changes that we make, we give plenty of time to roll those changes out. And particularly for our in-city groups, we want to give them time to make any changes to their participation fees that they may need to do. But as far as looking at the fees for our rental groups, we do think that this is something we'll be able to tackle fairly quickly and have in place for the spring upcoming season. So just to get a little bit further into the fee particulars, I did include our current fee structure, which you'll see in your packet. And one thing that you may notice is that generating revenue is really not the primary objective of how we have our fees structured. We do have tiered levels of access, and that's how we determine how to prioritize users on the fields. And that structure includes prioritizing our school athletics as well as our Newton Youth Athletics. So those groups are really, you know, they take priority and they are able to schedule and get the field time that they need to get play in for the amount of users that they have. Now we, of course, hear from some of our field users that we don't have enough fields, or sometimes there are conflicts in those field use. For example, if a baseball field is reserved and being used for baseball, we may not be able to use the outfield section for a lacrosse game or a soccer game. So those things do happen. An important piece of this is that our department does have a field scheduler that puts together the schedules, maintains a calendar of everything going on across all the fields, and make sure that there's not going to be any user conflicts that would happen because ideally everything is permitted out and put onto the schedule. I will say that you know, when you look at our fees, I think that there's some fairly easy things that jump out that could be looked at. In particular, our artificial turf fees and even our grass field fees most likely can be increased for some of our rentals. We're probably not meeting what I would call the market rate for some of those. And I think when we look at comparable communities, we will see that and be able to make some of those changes. But when we start talking about the fees, we are going to need to review and dig into a bit more complex issues And that will come into play as we review our tiers, our structure of how we prioritize the groups, and how we fit those groups into those tiers. So there's several different things we might look at when we have that conversation. It could include a discussion about residency requirements. If groups fitting within those tiers have a certain percentage of Newton residents versus non-residents participating. That look could include talking about nonprofit organizations, because oftentimes we look at our nonprofit organizations and have fee waivers or reduced fees, but we might want to take a deeper look into what is appropriate and who should be being charged what amounts. We have also started a conversation amongst the group of, should we have some non-waivable portion of field fees for all of our groups, including our in-city groups, and that would be able to put, revenues back into what we're hoping to do, which is to improve the quality and access to field space. So these are all discussions that we've just started to tackle. And we will certainly need some time to hold some of our meetings, collect feedback from all of our stakeholders, and figure out what's right for us in the way that we want to be permitting these fields. So just kind of wanted to give you a little bit of a brief overview about what I expect to tackle during this. Interestingly, I just finished a comprehensive review of field fees in my previous position. So I'm certainly aware of, the amount of details that will go into putting together a policy like this. I guess in a nutshell, I would say, I think we can move some things forward fairly quickly, but others I would ask that we, take our time and really take a look and analyze what those needs are. We also, we do generate revenue from field fees. The other item that was included in your packet is just an overview of what we've taken in for revenue this year. This year has been different than other years. We did close down our spring season entirely. So we're lacking in that piece of the revenue for this year, but we have all of our revenue history. So we know what we have been able to bring in. We do quite a few fee waivers. So, there are certain things that we don't assess field fees for, but for the most part for use of the artificial turf and use of field lights, we do assess some portion of a fee, especially with field lights that would go back into an operational cost for us. So those fees, just so everybody knows, do go into a revolving fund, which is overseen by the Parks and Recreation Department. That revolving fund is used operationally for us to run all of this field scheduling and field access for the community. So we do have costs within that revolving fund, such as our field scheduler, paying for the salary for that. We have the light and the electricity that we have for any of our fields and facilities, as well as doing improvements and maintenance on the fields. So those are the types of uses that revolving fund is utilized for. Other than that, I just think, I want to let everybody know that we actually have quite a few members of the fields subcommittee who are on the call here tonight, and I really appreciate them being here to support this. I think we've got a committee that is very willing to dig in and tackle this. And we've already started to pull together a lot of data that we can use for this. And we will start presenting that and discussing that as a group. So we'll be prepared to, look at recommendations and if appropriate, move those things forward. Recommendations would get made to our department. Anything that we did want to move forward, we would go through our full Parks and Recreation Commission. And then if it was something that was appropriate to bring forward to the city council, such as a fee change, we would do that as well. So you'll certainly be hearing more from us in the next coming months. So I just wanted to see, I can open it up for questions if anybody wants any more details or specifics.
Thank you, Commissioner Banks. Very much appreciated. I do see some hands up, so I will hold my questions. And Councillor Wright, followed by Councillor Baker. Councillor Wright?
Thank you very much. We've heard from our constituents a lot of complaints about fields maintenance and that it could be better. And you said that these fees do help cover some improvement in maintenance of the fields. What percentage are they covering of that cost, roughly? And this year you probably wouldn't use because you lost a lot of fees, you know, from your spring, canceling the spring, but in general, roughly do they cover 25% or 50%? And I believe also on top of that is some of our neighbor, and I think in our earlier presentations, that our fees are a lot lower than some of our neighbors. And so especially with outside groups, if we increase those fees, hopefully that could increase the maintenance of our fields.
Yeah, I would say that this revolving fund is really a supplemental fund for the maintenance at this point. So I don't believe it's covering a significant percentage. I don't know exactly what percentage. That's something we could take a look at, you know, comparing. We do, of course, have our maintenance division within the department and our appropriated budgets that are our primary source of that we use toward the maintenance. So anything that this account would be supplemental maintenance and in many cases improvements. So if we need a replacement of a soccer goal, or we're going to, you know, make an improvement to sort of a one-time improvement, that would be a source where it could go on. The ongoing types of things that get paid from out of this fund are really the permitting scheduling component of it, the electricity charges. Those are the operational needs ongoing. So the balance may increase a little bit, and then that can be reinvested back into a field project. But it's, you know, it's not a significant amount of revenue that is able to upkeep the maintenance needs for it.
So what is the maintenance budget roughly? Do you know?
I do not have that number off the top of my head. I can get that information for you.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Wright. Councillor Baker, followed by Councillor Leary. Councillor Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, appreciate all of this hard work. And the question I have is, there was an incident recently where apparently some people came to use one of the fields without permission, having not gone through all of the kind of hard work that the users in Newton have done. What is the policy, or how do you deal with what you might call rogue team, if there is such a thing? That's at least my...
Yeah, the field pirates, I've been calling them. So we have seen quite a bit of this, and I think some of it has been worse during COVID. We actually started hearing quite a few reports about our tennis courts, and we had private instructors, semi-private instructors, and really businesses that were setting up on our tennis courts and operating. And this really was the start of our discussions of how to tackle that issue. And it did absolutely spread to the fields. And so throughout the summer months, there were quite a few groups that were what we would consider organized groups using the fields who were not properly permitted. And this is an issue for a few reasons. Because we're not bringing in the revenue that we should be bringing in that would be reinvested back into these fields. And B, because we had no information on these groups. So we didn't have things in place like liability insurance. We didn't have a way to connect and reach out to them to review their COVID protocols. Things that if you're properly permitted through our department, we would have in place. So what we did, we actually, we reviewed our fields and facility policy. This is a policy, we have a detailed policy in place. This is what anybody would use to acquire a permit. We took a look at making the requirement in that policy for organized use, and particularly organized use with private gain. Was something that we needed to update our wording a little bit in our policy. So we worked with our legal team, we reviewed the wording, came up with some draft wording. We actually held a special Parks and Recreation Commission meeting in the summer when they typically don't meet. But this was such an important issue, and it was, you know, being brought up quite a bit through emails and phone calls and different people reporting these things to us. So we do now have the updated wording in our policy that we are able to, you know, let groups know that if you're not permitted, you do need to be in touch with the Parks and Recreation Department and to obtain a permit. So I do know there was one recently that was buzzing around a little bit, and we were able to get the information on what that group was and provide them with information on how to get properly permitted. The other thing that we've done is we've put together a handout that we can distribute. Our staff is able to distribute this, and we've also worked with the school department staff. The school department was having issues and having to have these conversations with some of the groups, and some of those were getting a little bit escalated and heated. So we came up with a handout just to be able to educate the organizations and also give them a way to be able to get in touch with us and get properly permitted. So that's where we have it to at this point.
So if I can just ask a follow-up, if they, you know, if it's a case of ignorance, we can understand, but if they're really trying to take advantage of us, what enforcement capacity do you have?
So that'll be a little bit of the next step, and we haven't fully implemented that. We do have the ability to have a fine on these groups, especially if it's a reoccurring issue. So, you know, if we've provided that education and information and this group continues to take advantage of the public property, you know, to run their functions and is unwilling to get a permit. So the next step on that is, you know, kind of moving beyond the education and providing that information. We would need to work together with our police department to be able to serve notice to the group that was not in compliance. And then at that point, we would be able to issue a civil fine that would be able to go through.
Maybe you should have a registration process.
Some of these conversations sound very familiar, whether it's leaf blowers or off-leash areas or field pirates. We're dealing with them all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Baker. Councilor Leary, and then Councilor Ryan. Councilor Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I just follow up quickly on the question of Councilor Wright on the budget?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so the budget of the public grounds team is about $2 million. Now, of the $2 million, certainly that includes staff. There are two line items that really deal with field maintenance and property maintenance, and that's about $650,000, which was level funded this year and maintained. So $650,000 for that specific category of things, not including the staff.
Thanks, Jonathan. We're very fortunate that you are at all times and can access that information. There you go. I appreciate it.
And Mr. Yeo, that number has actually gone up in the past few years, but most indications are that folks would like it to be significantly higher than that number.
Absolutely. Right? We had hoped to keep going upwards. Yeah.
Yep.
I have some internet problems. What was that number, 650K?
Correct.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's not just for fields. I would say there's about 75,000 that's been spent on seed and fertilization and 300K for mowing, and the mowing isn't always for fields. A lot of that budget is a maintenance budget, and there's a lot of items that are sort of
full. Yeah, it's difficult to
it's hard to figure out, but it's absolutely not anywhere near $165,000 that's being spent on our athletic fields. I just don't want people to get that impression.
Yeah, but it is a significant amount of money.
Staffing fields. So. We're a city of 90,000 people. It falls below, I think, what we need to keep our fields. That's the reason why we're here. That's the reason why I wanted to see how we could raise some money and figure out how we could better fund the program. And that's essentially, I'm very cognizant of the city budget. So I'm looking to improve the fields using a combination of CPA money and user fees and private money as well. And I've been working with the, working on this issue for about 2 years. So it's really not anything new. And I know people have been working on it before that. I think the combination of with climate change and higher use, it seems like our field quality went down substantially just in the last year or two. And I think a lack of investment in our fields over the years, and also a reluctance on the part of the city council to implement IPM program and utilize some herbicides when necessary and to not invest in artificial turf fields has also hurt us. So we have a lot of catching up to do. But I think it's really important tonight that we do focus on where we are where we need to get there. I think it's really important that we have the data, where we are now, and where we're going. And I wanted to know, Commissioner Banks, if we do have any data on how much it costs to bring our major playing fields. And I'm mostly interested in the larger rectangular fields, multi-use fields. I think our baseball fields generally are in better shape and have pretty good stewardship and don't get quite as much use. How much would it to take to bring those playing fields up to an industry standard of good to excellent? Do we know that?
Yeah, so I mentioned, you know, part of the work of this group will be to look at a lot of the projects that we have. And we do have several projects that are on our CIP list. We also have some projects that were mentioned in our open space and recreation plan. We do have some cost estimates put together for those. It will really depend on what the site is and what we decide to do. So if we're talking about a multi-purpose field, so I'm going to say, you know, a full-size 11x11 field that could be used for lacrosse, it could be broken into multiple smaller fields for soccer or be used, as the largest size soccer field that you would need. To redo a grass field and irrigate it and put new sub-base materials, get the crowning and water drainage that you need. You know, one full-size soccer field, $350,000, I would probably give as an estimate. $350,000.
Are you saying that all our fields need $350,000 worth of
work? That would be a full renovation. So that's what I mean, really looking at each specific location and determining what we would do there. If we need to overseed and fertilize and add irrigation, that could be a much less expensive project. Mm-hmm. So we've started the discussion a little bit with the Fields Committee, and we do have in our capital plan, we have several artificial turf fields. We feel very fortunate to have three artificial turf fields. Our capital plan includes the carpet replacement for those fields, and that's estimated at $700,000 for each field. So one of the things that our committee will need to discuss and work through is, do we invest in a fourth artificial turf field to a much larger initial contribution needed, and then know that we have those carpet replacements coming down the line every 12 years? Or do we look at some of our grass fields and bringing up the level of play and working on the grass turf and be able to do, significantly more upgrades to those type of fields? We just recently did our first treatment, our fertilizer and pesticide treatment to three fields. And we had really an impactful difference we felt that came from that. Being able to treat the fields and eliminate those weeds really set the turf, made the grass come in that much thicker. And so if we have fields that are pretty level, don't have any drainage issues, looking at that. We've also discussed irrigation, and that's another possible solution for some fields. We are, taking a look at what is bringing on irrigation, how would that affect our maintenance budget and long-term being able to take care of all of those irrigation lines. I believe right now we have about 24 fields that are that are irrigated. And so, you know, there could be some expansion to be done there too. So there's a few different ways that we could go about investing funds. You mentioned CPA funds. And so I think that's something to really think through. How do we get the most value out of that money, and what would most help our user groups?
I understand that the IPM committee's work there and getting those three fields with some herbicide use what exceeded expectations. I just hope that we continue to follow up, because, you know, fields need constant work, as you know. The only upside from this pandemic is our fields have been rested for the first time in a long time, but we can't depend on a pandemic to do that.
Yeah, we have to address that through scheduling then, if we're going to try to continue with, you know, having a rotation of resting fields. That will have to be done through scheduling.
Yeah, I hope we also can think about sort of a shorter term capital improvement that will help us, more quickly open up, increase our capacity for fields. And, you know, and when I was looking through the Parks and Commission meeting records, and they have been talking about this for a couple of years now, and they already had talked about Forte Park because it already has lights. It's already got a pocket of money coming out of the Riverdale project, something around $200,000. And it would probably be a very likely location for a turf field, and you could use the CPA money to improve the lights. That was just, I would love to see something kind of immediate come out of this discussion as well, so that we can relieve the sort of some of the pressure on our fields. I had one question about your, and I'm really glad that we're looking at our tier system fees, because just my quick look is that we are undervaluing them, and I understand we're not wanting to we want to make it easy for people to participate in sports and don't want to create any hardship. But at the same time, I do think user fees is a sensible way to help to contribute to the maintenance of the fields itself, and not just paying for staff and all those ongoing costs that we have to do. But how do you figure out whether an Aneuton adult group is more than 65% or less than 65% and charge accordingly? That seems like a hard thing to do.
So when you talk about residency requirements, when we permit to a group, then we would require them to submit their roster. So they would have to complete their registration process and submit their roster. Typically what would happen is we would have groups that would be assessed by the department, and then we would know which category they fell into. We would have to update those residency requirements if they had a large shift, or change to what their makeup is. So that is an extra step for our staff to have to oversee, but we would require them to submit a roster to us with, you know, the residency information provided.
Okay, and my last point is that if we are going to be renting out fields to non-Newton groups or adult groups or professional organizations and nonprofits, I do think we should be making sure we're getting our value from that. I understand that Fessenden gets $100,000 a year just from their one field, mostly from soccer. And it looks like we get about a total of $155,000 a year in fees in a typical year. So I think there's room for improvement there. But yes, thank you very much.
That's correct, and I agree. I think the user fees are really important. And for the most part, these groups are charging participation fees. So we're asking for a portion of those then to come back into supporting the fields that they play on.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Councillor Larry. Last do I have are Councillor Ryan and then Councillor Humphrey. Councillor Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Banks. I have a few questions. Did I hear you right when you said that the field committee was being restarted?
Yes, I tried to make that slip that in there. And I think Councillor Leary alluded to this too. There has been a subcommittee of the Parks and Recreation Commission that has not been active, but that did work previously. And I believe a lot of the work, they did not review the field fees. So that wasn't a component of it, but I think really trying to look at all of the field projects and, you know, trying to prioritize some of those, trying to get the athletic groups together at the table, because what you'll find, and I've had one-on-one meetings with almost all of our sport group representatives, you know, each sport group, as they should, is advocating for their own sport, and may have an idea of a particular field site or, you know, a place that they feel would be a good home base for them, would be an improvement that would help their constituents. And so really trying to bring all those groups together at the table can be difficult because there are competing needs that happen there. And so, you know, really with reconvening, we're trying to get to a point where we say, you know, as a group, really try to understand that we want to be able to move forward in a direction. And that might be, you know, a multi-year process of looking at, you know, being able to do something for each of the groups, but having them support one project at a time or a grouping of projects together so that we can bring something forward that, you know, meets the most needs. And it's not an easy task. And that's my understanding, is that it got difficult to get the groups to the point of moving that forward.
Okay, thank you. I agree with Council Larry that I think that part of the contract with these groups, it should state how much is going back in for the upkeep of the field, or the fields or the field they're using. One of my questions was answered a bit, but I want to go a little further on it. It was on the tennis courts. I know that the most used tennis courts are the two high schools, especially Newton South, and probably Newton Center Playground and some other place that I don't know. But then we have tennis courts behind some of the schools and, you know, in Newton Upper Falls at, I think it's Braceland Field. And in those cases, if you have people that live in the neighborhood, you know, let's say it's two kids that grab tennis rackets and balls and go up and want to use it, or you have a bunch of kids like we did when I was young. It was a lot different way back then, but you know, you could get together a pickup baseball game and you'd go up to, in my case, it was Memorial School's playground, which is still there, and the same field's still there, and the same two tennis courts are still there, and just go use the field. The only time that we knew better was when the Newton East Little League was playing, or the adult softball league that was every Monday night. And if they have a conflict, because I was caught in the middle of this summer, and I'm not so sure that this person was paying, but there was the same person would show up every Saturday morning and basically have a clinic with students that I know he was charging. And when a couple of neighborhood people, they weren't kids or adults, wanted to use the two courts beside each other, he started to give him a hard time. And I said to him, well, do you have like a contract with the city? Well, I have permission from the city. Well, he should have said, I'm paying for this, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the challenge, is we want these facilities to be, you know, permitted out properly, but we want them to be available to the residents.
Yeah.
Drop in and use them. That's what they're here for. So, you know, when we have a permitted organization, we can say, okay, we've booked out this court for this many hours, or we're using one court for this, or if there's just two tennis courts, we might not do permitting there at all. So there's a few things with that. We do have a city tennis program, and we are going to be working with our tennis contractor to make sure that if they are teaching private lessons, they have a very visible symbol to show, you know, a brightly colored permit piece of paper that they will display there, so that our residents can know that, okay, this is the city's program that's happening. Anybody who has a permit that would not be the city contractor should be able to show their permit. And we ask them to have that with them, either show it on a cell phone or have a printout copy of it. So that is something that can be requested. But then a lot of times you get, you know, the feedback that, oh, well, we're, you know, we've set this up and we're allowed to be here, but we can't show the permit. So that would not be the case that they are really permitted to use it.
Well, yeah, well, I would know better now that you said that. But so it would also be another thing where it'd be hard to enforce, because I'm talking about, in this case, weekends. It's a Saturday morning. But there is, you know, you could say to someone, that a neighbor, that can't, if the person was paying for it, well, you could, you know, the way to get out of it, I think easy, would say, well, they're paying to rent this. And as you know, it's not, you know, you can come in most any other time and be able to use the court, and it pays for the upkeep of the court. It would be a way to get out of it easy with the neighbors. But I would just think it would be hard to, you can't enforce it if it's on the weekend to start with. But I agree, we should, these groups, especially someone that's profiting from a school, basically, if they're not paying us this, we got to get on top of that.
Yeah, so we have the policy updated now, and we do have a Friends of Newton Tennis Group. So I've been a little bit slow stepping this just because of COVID. And, you know, there is a lot of high anxiety when you approach people these days. So, you know, I don't really want to be sending people out to get into any kind of a confrontational situation. Really, you know, I've been trying to keep this held with our staff to provide notice where we can and really handle it educationally right now. But, you know, we can take further steps to, you know, see if Friends of Newton Tennis would distribute handouts for us. You know, they are the ones who are out and about in the community, and a lot of times are taking care of these court sites. So, you know, I think we can do some more work. Will we fix all of it? Probably not. And we're not the only community that has this issue. You know, I hear about this across our association all the time. This is being talked about and quite a bit right now, because a lot of these businesses had to move outdoors, who sometimes had, you know, an indoor location. Right now, they just wanted to get outdoors. And so they showed up, you know, at our community resource tennis courts or fields to operate their business.
Okay, one more quick question. It's on vandalism. Do we have a lot? And if there's vandalism to a turf field as opposed to a natural field, which is more expensive to fix? In other words, someone driving a car on the field and doing what we used to call donuts.
So I've been here for 7 months, and we've had a turf field damaged by vandalism and one grass field. So one for a grass and an artificial turf. It would really depend on the amount of damage that was done. You could do significant damage to a grass field by driving over it. Unfortunately, not all of our fields have complete separation. So a lot of them will have, you know, a fencing or some bollard system to stop a car from going through. They don't all have that. I don't know that happens a lot. It hasn't since I've been here. And, you know, the artificial turf involves bringing in a contractor who specifically can work on that. The vandalism that we had happen within the last 6 months was one section got burned. And so the fix for that was, you know, it wasn't overly expensive because they could patch just that one section. So, you know, if it's just one area, I think it's not too bad expense-wise, but if it's significant, it could get quite expensive.
Do you track how much we pay, let's say, on vandalism?
So for vandalism, when we have anything happen, we make sure that we have a police report filed, and that information, you know, we take photos and make sure we put that in before we fix it, just so we can track that. I'm guessing that our maintenance division probably keeps a list of that. I'd have to check in with our superintendent of grounds maintenance to see what he's doing, but I know we report it and we make sure that it goes into the, you know, police reporting system.
Okay, I just wondered how much, I'm not asking for it now, if it's just tracked as part of what the budget is every year, what cost goes to vandalism. That's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Banks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Ryland. Councilor Humphrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So following up briefly on Councilor Baker's comments and tying this back to the earlier discussion on leaf blowers, as well as what Councilor Ryan just spoke about, as we're hearing tonight, there are some enforcement challenges at our athletic fields and facilities, and I've discussed them several times this year with Commissioner Banks, as Ward 5 residents had brought them up to me, including the aforementioned tennis court issues that Ms. Kantar and Mr. Jampol have talked about, as well as the football field pirates that Mr. Levy talked about, that Councilor Baker just alluded to. And I also know Mr. Traxler is in the meeting watching tonight, and he has raised concerns to me and many others related to damage from dogs on the soccer field or whatever else, other similar safety issues. But as Council President Albright has said, the solution here is not just to like keep passing more and more ordinances if we don't have a good way of enforcing them, because that's not really going to help the situation either. So I think this here, again, as with the leaf blower issue that we discussed earlier tonight, kind of goes to show that this is another example, at least, of where we simply don't need an armed police response. That wouldn't be helpful, but it would be helpful as a community, I think, to make a priority of having some sort of unarmed code enforcement team or somebody that can hand over those letters that you were describing. And we'd probably end up saving some money by protecting appropriate use of our fields. We could use those to invest in the quality of the fields. But I just wanted to get that comment out there for the record tonight as an aside from this broader discussion of how much money we do need to get into our fields to get them where they need to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Humphrey. And Commissioner Banks, I want to thank you for the work you're doing on this. I think Councilor Leary has spoken about it, and I know a number of us have very serious concerns about the condition of our fields across the city. I think you share some of those concerns, and I appreciate that. And I think a number of us have been working to try and figure out how best to approach this problem, what the best ways are, and what the best ways are to generate some of the resources that we really need to fix these fields. I know Mr. Yeo spoke earlier about the budget, which sort of, you know, taken by itself sounds like a lot of money, but I think most of us recognize that it's dramatically insufficient to actually provide the types of recreational fields that the folks of Nerton deserve, and frankly, pay for by living here in the city. So appreciate the work that you're doing on this front to try and get those resources generated. I'm definitely supportive of the efforts to evaluate the fee structure throughout the city. So thank you for that work that you're doing. Does anyone else have any other questions? I see none. I had hoped to be done by 8:30, so I see that we are right on time. I think we probably want to hold this. It sounds like this is an ongoing matter that I'm guessing the committee wants to hear more about. I know I'd like to hear more about as your working group evolves and comes up with some recommendations. So with that, item 390-20, if anyone wanted to make a motion to hold, it would be appropriate. President Albright, you have your hand up. You're on mute, Madam President. You're still muted, Madam President.
Sorry, I was just saying it can wait. I'll just move hold.
Okay. We have hold.
Mr. Chair.
Councilor Leary, discussion on the motion to hold. Yes, go ahead, Councilor Leary.
I'm not on this committee, but I'm in full agreement motion to hold. But I just wanted to know if we could give the commissioner some guidance about what kind of information would be helpful for when this comes back before the committee, because I think it's really important for us to understand the data, the budget, you know, how much is actually spent on the fields,
what kind of money we need to get up to, you know, good quality fields, and what the strategies will be to get us there. And I also think we should be looking at, you know, a CPA project as well.
Definitely fair questions, fair points. I think we know the answer is somewhere between $0 and $350,000 times the number of fields in the city. In that range is what we need. We just need to hone in on a little bit. I think the points you raise are good ones. Does anyone else on the committee want to weigh in with other information that they'd like to hear back on at some point in the future?
Yeah. May I? I'm going to put my list on the table because Councillor Humphrey raised the issue of enforcement. You know, some cities and towns are talking about park ranger kind of people that have ticketing authority. And that brings us right back to the same old problem we've been having, is that parks, and I don't think you have the authority to ticket, you know, at least not for the dogs. And it's kind of circular. Solving the problem for the dog enforcement would help in solving the problem of the park enforcement as well. It's just one more reason to solve that problem. That's all I just wanted to say.
Fair point. Thank you. Councilor, was there anything else you wanted to raise? I think you should be in there in terms of
I would volunteer to get on my horse and gallop around and enforce, do more enforcement. We get a crew together.
You go. I think we'd all like to see that.
I don't know that they're exactly the same issue, only because I don't believe the police department has the ticketing authority for, you know, field and facility policy issues. That's not to say that our department is ready to go now for enforcement, but you know, we have to work through how does the notification have to happen in order for us to serve the fine. But we do have the ability to fine $250 per occurrence. So, you know, if there was somebody teaching a tennis lesson every Saturday, those fines could add up. The issue is, you know, we don't have a park ranger system like you mentioned, where we have an entity to, you have to get the person's specific information and you have to serve the violation directly to them. And so that's why we may need to involve the police department on that. I'm not certain yet. So we'll have to review that piece.
We're just a small town that doesn't really realize we're a big city. I just, you know, it used to be, right? It used to be everyone knew who your mother was, right? So.
Fair enough. Yeah. All right, so the motion on the table is a motion to hold. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay. I think we have lost Councillor Baker and Councillor Greenberg, but the rest of us have voted to hold. And thank you, Commissioner Banks. Thank you, Mr. Yeo. Thank you, members of the public who have joined us. Thank you for those watching on New TV, if you're still watching on New TV. If not, to those of you working at New TV who are still logged in, thank you for joining us. With that, I think we're ready to adjourn. FYI to the committee, not sure yet about a meeting next week. I don't know that we have a lot on the agenda, so we may be in a position to cancel. I will certainly let folks know by the end of the week. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a good night.
Good night.